You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening here.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
And I've seen German politicians and former judges rail at this and say, what have you done to our country? You have sworn an oath of office to protect and defend Germany and to promote the general welfare, and you're not doing it by letting in a wave of people who speak no known language, who have no ties to the area of culture, of religion, of history, or anything else, and suddenly you lose track of them all. How does this happen? It's just astonishing.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, J. Michael Springman. Today's show, Migration as Asymmetric Warfare. Michael Springman is a former diplomat in the State Department's Foreign Service, with postings to Germany, India, Saudi Arabia, and the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in Washington, D.C. He was chief of the non-immigrant visa section in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, from 1987 to 1989. His latest book is Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb, in which he provides an in-depth analysis of the migrant flood, its causes, and what it means for Europe. Building on arguments put forward in his classic work, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, An Insider's View, he reveals how U.S. foreign policy created the crisis. As an ex-State Department official and attorney, his insider knowledge of U.S. policy reveals a world where immigrants become weapons, nationalism is condemned, and civil liberties hang in the balance. Michael Springman, welcome. It's great to have you back on again.
Well, it's good to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
In your new book about the migrant crisis facing Europe, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb, you pay special attention to Germany and German Chancellor Angela Merkel. I knew that Angela Merkel is the daughter of a Lutheran minister and that she's from East Germany, the former German Democratic Republic. You have some more information on her, but not a whole lot. What do we know about Merkel and her background?
Well, she's very good at concealing her background. She was born in Hamburg and taken as an infant to the East, where she and her family got special treatment because her father created a branch of the Lutheran Church that was subservient, in a sense, to the East German government and worked, in fact, to help prop up that government. And Merkel grew up there, spent 35 years in the East, joined the Free German Youth. Because her father was subservient to the government, she got to study at prestigious schools, went on to get a PhD in physics, and this was at a time when the clergy's children were routinely refused advantages. They had cars, they had trips abroad, that kind of thing. And in my research for the book, I found that Jonathan Powell, who had been chief of staff to former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, he had described Merkel as a ruthless, vicious politician. And then, of course, Mama Merkel portrays herself as mother of the nation, and she's has her arms open to all the children of the world who want to come to Germany. And from what I can see, that's not the case. I'll give you a further example. She was very close to Lothar de Maizière, the last non-communist head of the East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, and she knew all his background. She became a protege of Helmut Kohl, the West German chancellor at the time and head of the Christian Democratic Union, the large center-right party. And it seems somehow, in some way, Kohl's background in slush funds, illegal financial transactions, black money, you name it, somehow became public. And Kohl was removed as head of the party. The guy next in line to be head of the party had been Lothar de Maizière, but somehow, some way, the information got out to the press that this guy had a background in the Stasi, the state security service that spied on everybody and everyone in East Germany. And the only person close to either of them who knew all their dark secrets was Angela Merkel. So I think that she has a public persona and a private persona. And there's a lot of stuff in the private persona that I think we need to know and don't.
So what is your assessment of Angela Merkel? Is there evidence, or have you found any evidence, that she was involved with the East German Stasi?
Well, they claimed that she had resisted the one attempt to recruit her. But then she'd also been involved in agitation and propaganda when she was part of the East German Youth. And the funny thing is, other people whom she had known in the East and were part of the Stasi, she's brought into her government. There was an Annetta Kahana, whose code name was Victoria with the Stasi. She now has indirect control of Germany's war on hate speech. And Merkel's justice minister had recruited her and the organization that she had founded, something called Network Against Nazis, to define and control controversial language. Hmm. And the Adara press apparently came out at one point and accused her of being a Stasi informant, with her being an unofficial associate with the security service. And, you know, Merkel's always maintained that she's only been involved in cultural affairs with the Free German Youth and was not involved with the bad boys at all. So, you know, people say things, but whether or not they can prove it, I don't know. There's one guy who apparently had been involved in writing a news article with Der Spiegel. He had claimed that she had also been a secretary for agitation and propaganda when she was in the Free German Youth. So, you know, there's all speculation. There's people talking. But she never admits her closeness to the old East German system. And at one point had is supposed to have said, if reform East Germany, it won't be in terms of the West German Federal Republic. So I guess the imprint, I guess, of the old East German ways are still in her mindset, and she's going to command and control from the top instead of doing a conciliatory democracy like her predecessors had done.
According to your book, Germany's Federal Office for Migration and Refugees tweeted on August 25th, 2015, quote, "We are no longer enforcing the Dublin procedures for Syrian citizens." What are the Dublin procedures, and have they been reinstituted?
Well, the Dublin procedure was the idea that you get to the European Union, and whichever country in the European Union you get to first, you apply for asylum or refugee status there, not wandering from country to country and trying to find the best deal, kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. And as far as I know, they've been trying to reinstitute the Dublin procedures, but they've not been successful at it.
Now, I also read in your book that in 2015, Austria and Germany abolished the law temporarily, and migrants didn't need to register. Is that true?
Yes. I was told by the Austrian embassy, I'd sent them an email and said, well, you know, can you give me some figures on the wave of migrants through Austria? And I was told, no, we can't, because there was such a flood that we couldn't keep track of them. They just poured across the border and kept going.
The surge of immigrants into Germany began in early spring of 2015. Mm-hmm. Is there evidence of a clandestine human smuggling operation planned, funded, and coordinated by foreign intelligence agencies?
Well, I've not found anything that says, yes, indeed, these guys did this there and then. But from my readings and from my research and from what other people have written, I think that this was planned and this was carried out. At one point, for example, I've read that the American government was funding boats for migrants, and the French government was helping distribute them to refugees in Turkey so they could go across the Ionian Sea to Greece. I've seen things that talked about how there were organizations in Syria and other countries that were creating nearly perfect counterfeit Iraqi and Syrian passports. And I'm not sure how you can do this in a country where it's all you can do to get enough to eat and you don't even have time to pray. I've also read that the security services who were supposedly watching these people somehow lost track of them. And I'm not quite sure how, if it's your job to follow someone, you can suddenly lose him all of a sudden. That's been the big issue. There have been organizations, for example, like Cisco Systems, that somehow out of the goodness of their heart contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to non-governmental organizations like Mercy Corps and NetHope to handle refugees and to set up Wi-Fi arrangements in the Balkans on the migrant routes to bring people north and west. People have their expensive cell phones that somehow connect to the internet and guide them to where they want to go. They can get them their the price of a smuggler in Greece or what it costs to go from Turkey to Germany. So it's very, very peculiar. And we've got people like George Soros, who's always the big bad boogeyman. He is supposedly coming up with apps for iPhones to help guide these people. His Central European University in Budapest, which is being targeted by the Hungarian government for its strange extracurricular activities, they've recruited interpreters to help people move and get themselves asylum in Europe. So there's enough there that it's, you're 50 to 75% certain that the intelligence services are doing it, but you can't figure out exactly who is doing it and name names and times of day and things like this.
Yes, I'd like to go into some of that in a little bit more detail. But first, how would you characterize the majority of the migrants into Europe? Are they families? And if not, who are they?
They're mostly young, single men. In Sweden, I think it was something like 70% of the applicants for asylum or refugee status were young, single men, below 35. There are some families, there are some wives, and there are some children. In many cases, there are tens of thousands of unaccompanied children who are also mostly male, and they all seem to disappear. I think they've lost track of something like 10,000 unaccompanied minors at one point.
Now, I've heard estimates, and I think you mentioned it in your book, that as many as 300,000 immigrants have simply disappeared upon entering Germany, that the German government has no record of these people and they don't know who they are.
Exactly right. I was astounded when I saw this, and I said, well, look, you've got Germany where if you're coming to the country as a foreigner and you register in a hotel room, they take all your particulars and give them to the local police force. If you're an illegal alien, like many of these people are, you should be doubly checked as to who you are and what you're doing there. I mean, the Germans have the federal criminal police who have jurisdiction across the country and who cooperate with the local police in each of the German states, the lender. And then you've got the Internal Security Service, the Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution. It's their job and the job of all these police forces to keep track of people and to ensure that you have domestic tranquility and you don't have a gang of terrorists running loose in the country. And you need to know who is there and what they're doing. And I've seen German politicians and former judges rail at this and say, what have you done to our country? You have sworn an oath of office to protect and defend Germany and to promote the general welfare, and you're not doing it by letting in a wave of people who speak no known language, who have no ties to the area of culture, of religion, of history, or anything else, and suddenly you lose track of them all. And how does this happen? It's just astonishing.
I'm speaking with former U.S. diplomat, attorney, and author Michael Springman. Today's show, Migration as Asymmetric Warfare. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. A well-known author living in Germany told me off the record that it's dangerous now for women to go out at night and that the German government prosecutes people who speak out against immigrant crime. What do we know about this?
Well, that's unfortunately all too true. I mean, all the feminists in Germany, I'm surprised they're not screaming blue bloody murder at the demands that if they go out alone, they shouldn't do it. They should go out with a male escort. They shouldn't go out by themselves at night alone, that it's dangerous. They've had attacks all over the country, and they're still picking up. I've read how they've had knifings in Hamburg and a shootout in a nightclub in Konstanz in the south of Germany. And it's astonishing. There are demands for segregated gymnasium hours, segregated swimming pool hours, and people are balking at this or saying this is our country, we shouldn't have to adapt to the foreigners, and yet it's the other way around. And Merkel and her government are imposing sanctions on people for hate speech, it's very broadly defined. If you go on Facebook and say that these people should be shot, they should be driven out of town, they should be tarred and feathered or something similar, it's not, you know, imminent death to these people. It's spouting off at politicians who don't do anything about this. Well, they get fined. They get suspended prison sentences. And one guy was thrown in jail with a big fine because he had said that Merkel and her ministers should be stood up against the wall and shot because they've abandoned Germany to a gang of aliens.
Is Germany's constitution under attack? What executive changes have been instituted by Chancellor Merkel? Now, we've just been talking about free speech. I guess that's something, huh?
Yes, indeed. The German constitution very specifically and flatly says that freedom of speech is inviolate. And it talks about speech itself. It talks about letters. It talks about telephone calls. It talks about emails and electronic communications. And yet, when somebody speaks out like this, they're in a world of trouble because the government comes down on them. And the German government claims, oh, well, this is hate speech, and we have a section in the law against hate speech. Well, there's hate speech, and there's asking questions, there's demanding answers from politicians, and Merkel seems to have gone overboard on this, and she seems to have not only changed by executive order what free speech really means, she's also increased surveillance of Germans. They increased controls on legitimate travelers at the border. They've gotten into the intelligence services reading people's emails and telephone conversations. They are going on about how we have to have security in Germany, and it's a security at the price of liberty, very much like the United States. Oh, we want to be protected from terrorists. We want to protect you from terrorists. And at the same time, they're cutting back on actual freedom. So it's not the right wing that's howling for men on horseback and the revival of Adolf Hitler. It's the center left, the center right governments of Europe, in particular Germany and France and Britain, who are engaged in investigating and controlling and secretly spying on people.
And with regard to crime, is there evidence that the German Internal Intelligence Service won't or can't do its job?
It appears so. I mean, there are two really well-known examples. One was this fellow, Anas Amri, who was a migrant, and he had stolen a truck in Berlin and driven it into the Breitscheidplatz Christmas market in the center of town, killing and wounding a number of people. And he was known to have had a history of being jailed in Italy. And he had been on a watch list by the German Internal Security Service, the Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution. He had been on the American no-fly list. He had at one point said he had told an informant for the Federal Criminal Police that he wanted to do something in Germany. He wanted an AK-47 to do it with. Yet they didn't seem this was enough to arrest him or to follow him more closely, and in fact dropped their surveillance of him about 6 months before the attack at the Christmas market. There was another instance in southwest Germany in the university town of Freiburg where this Hussein Kavari, an Afghan migrant, had raped and murdered by drowning Maria Ladenburger, a young 19-year-old, beautiful medical student, when she was bicycling home from a party. She, in fact, had worked at migrant homes trying to help out the people who were flooding Germany at the time, although apparently she didn't know her attacker. But in the case of this guy Kavari and Ladenburger, they kept a lid on it for months, and only because the social media got a hold of it, and then the press did anything come of it, and people started asking questions, what's going on, what's happening? Didn't you know this guy had been jailed in Greece for trying to throw a woman over a cliff, and he had been let out of jail early, and he skipped parole, and suddenly he turned up in Germany, and they couldn't deport him because he had no papers. That was the same story with the guy in Berlin at the Breitscheidplatz. He didn't have any papers, so they couldn't get rid of him. They denied his asylum claim. Yet at the same time, they had found several different documents in the truck and elsewhere listing several different identities and several different passports. So you really wonder, are they really this incompetent, or is there somewhere how a dark fifth column in the security services?
And what about the mainstream media in the United States and in Europe? Are they doing a very good job of covering the situation with the waves of immigration into Europe?
Not in my view. I mean, it pops up occasionally in the United States that they'd had a number of articles in the Washington Post at the time of the New Year's Eve attacks in December 2015. But by and large, if you have something, it's a small box item saying that in Konstanz there was a shootout in a nightclub or there was a knifing in Hamburg. But it's basically the bare bones. There's no explanation. There's no background. I, in fact, have gotten a questionnaire from a German publishing company saying that in Germany the people don't believe the press is free anymore. And from what I've seen in the research for the book, that's pretty true. They kept a tight lid on what really happened on the New Year's Eve rapes, robberies, and beatings. And again, that only came out when people started talking to social media and to the press.
In terms of the migrations from the Middle East, et cetera, into Europe generally, from reading your book, it looked like there was a huge movement in 2015, 2016. How many people, do they know how many people in the last few years have actually emigrated into Europe from the South? And where does that situation stand today?
Well, they don't rightly know. I mean, they have estimates that go up and down. I mean, in Germany, they say at least a million people, if not more, have turned up there and registered. Other countries, such as in the Balkans, just simply passed them through, like Slovenia. They created a corridor where the migrants could move through. The aim is not so much to end up in Greece or Slovenia or Serbia, which are essentially poor countries, where in Serbia, a policewoman makes $300 a month, which is barely enough to buy a new computer. They're going north and west to the benefit-rich countries of Europe, and they come in such numbers that if they don't register, nobody can keep track of them.
Could you tell us about the tweets that supposedly came from Merkel and Germany, but which mostly came from the U.S., the U.K., and Australia, saying that Germany and Austria were the most refugee-welcoming countries in Europe? When were these tweets sent out? And what about the existence of net bots in these tweets? What are net bots?
Well, net bots, as I understand it, I'm not an expert on electronics, but I looked them up on Norton, the antivirus people, and they say that, well, they seize control of a computer and turn it into a repeater. You send something to this computer, and then the computer sends it out to another computer, and then that goes to still another computer. And these are all linked, and they send out whatever messages you want, and the computer and the computer operator don't know this. They've just been taken over secretly. And the tweets came out after the migrants started moving. And who did this and how they did this, I don't know. I think this is another one of these examples of the intelligence services' involvement, because your average guy doesn't know how to do this. And I can't see why a hacker would suddenly become interested in sending out welcoming notices saying, hey, go to Germany or go to Austria. It's benefit rich. Leave Syria, leave Libya, leave sub-Saharan Africa and go there. They just simply came and they happened, and nobody knows where they came from. And they, besides the U.S. And other places, large developed countries, they were coming out of Nepal and other small countries. And you really wonder about this. It's you can't pin it down, and it raises more questions than it answers, really, I think.
Well, now, obviously, a lot, if not most of these people that are migrating to Europe are coming because of the wars, the U.S. instituted wars in many countries, what, Iraq, Syria, Libya, etc., etc. In the preface to your new book, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Sylvia Germick says that refugees are normally organized in camps near their own countries, with the intention of returning. This does not seem to have been the case for many years.
Well, that's exactly right. And Sylvia had a lot of experience in this, working with non-governmental organizations involved with migrants and migration. And she had some ties to the intelligence service as well, as I understand it. So she's entirely correct on this. I mean, you don't need to move an entire population from the Middle East to Northern Europe. The idea is to stop the war, stop the fighting, create a camp to tend to these people's needs, give them food and water and education, and then send them back home once you've repaired the broken water mains, the destroyed sewage treatment plants, and so forth. But this is not happening. The Americans have gotten the Europeans into this and have joined their forever war and are continuing to bomb and destroy whole countries and drive their populations out, who are then guided into Europe.
And what about the role of non-governmental organizations or NGOs? NGOs are found around the world in many countries. Are all NGOs American in origin, or do other countries sponsor them?
Well, other countries do. I mean, you've got George Soros' Global Society network of all his organizations in Europe and in Britain and Germany and so on. Then you've got a number of these non-governmental organizations that seem to have shadowy backgrounds. I mean, whether it was Welcome to Europe, W2EU, that seems to have no real basis in origin, no fixed base, but somehow they're bringing in migrants by the thousands. You have groups of ships. There's a German organization that I think it's called Sea Watch that gets ships into the Mediterranean to intercept the small boats the migrants are in and take them to safety in Europe and turn them loose. So it's everything from well-known organizations like George Soros' Open Society people, and you've also got this Sea Watch, and you've got Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, and you've got organizations I've never heard of before that I mentioned in the book that somehow bring these people across as well. And they advocate for them, they agitate for them. They work very hard to bring these people across and make sure they get to the right place at the right time and they get themselves into the country so that they can't be thrown out again.
I'm speaking with former U.S. diplomat, attorney, and author Michael Springman. Today's show, Migration as Asymmetric Warfare. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What about humanitarian NGOs in war zones? Do many of them serve as CIA front organizations? She seemed to indicate this.
Yeah, in particular, Mercy Corps does this. They're all involved in American war zones in Iraq, in Yugoslavia, and they come and they go and they come and they go. When things cool down, they move out. When they heat up, they move back in. And some of the Mercy Corps people have been arrested for espionage. So I think that these people's hands are not clean, and I've seen articles on RT where they've had a number of Germans saying that we are going to organize a group called Defend Europe to counter these people that are bringing in the migrants and the ones that somehow have ties to the intelligence services.
The United Nations created a commitment to responsibility to protect, R2P, in 2005, which allowed for Western peacekeeping missions or invasions based on humanitarian concerns. How does R2P work?
Well, as it's in the past, it's been used as a means of American and NATO aggression against given countries, such as Yugoslavia. That's where the concept was first created. Then they used it to justify their invasion and destruction of Libya. And they keep bringing it up in terms of Syria, where we have to do something and have a safe zone, have a no-fly zone, have a safety corridor, et cetera. And it's basically a way of moving armed forces into a given country without that country's permission and without a declaration of war by the sending states.
Do the migrant streams constitute a strategy of tension? You've mentioned the strategy of tension in your book.
Yes, they do. It comes out of Kelly Greenhill's book, Weapons of Mass Migration, which came out about 7 years ago, which pretty much shows a blueprint on how to do this and what works and what doesn't work and why. The idea is that you weaken a country by moving people out of it, and then you weaken another country by moving these same people into it. The losing country loses its doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs. It doesn't have capitalists to finance businesses. It doesn't have professionals to manage these businesses. It doesn't have teachers to educate the children. And in the case of the alleged receiving state, although I don't know if you can call it receiving, they've been pummeled and pounded by this flood, they have to cope with this. They have to come up with the money to feed them, to house them, to educate them, to teach them a known language. There is no pool of native Dari speakers or Arabic speakers in Europe. And in the case of the migrants going into Europe, you know, how many of them speak German? How many of them speak Italian? But what happens in the receiving state is you have more tension because you have the groups of people who welcome them saying, oh, we have to help them. They're leaving a war zone. They have nothing but they can carry in their own two hands. We need to educate them and give them a place to live and integrate them into our society. And then you have the natives who say, well, wait a minute. It's our country. We get to decide who comes in, who stays, who goes, et cetera. And you have the fights then that are created between the migrants and the natives, and then the fights between the two groups of natives. So you wind up with tension and hostility and hatred on all sides.
Well, you mentioned the book by Kelly Greenhill, Weapons of Mass Migration, and you just got through saying that she wrote this book about 7 years ago. Was
Yes.
this book, Weapons of Mass Migration, was this simply analysis of what was already happening? Or was it somehow a theory or a formulation to show how this could be done? What do you think of her book?
Well, the book itself was an analysis of some 64 different events, everything from the Haitian boat people to migrants being pushed out of North Korea in the hopes of weakening the North Korean government, plus a few others. But I think looking at the book, and reading through it and analyzing it, I think it's a handbook on how to use these weapons of mass migration, how to exploit democratic societies. Because she says in the book in a couple of different places that the Achilles heel of liberal democratic democracies is that they have somewhere along the way signed conventions and agreements about migrants and asylees and helping them and bring them into the country if they're fleeing for their lives. And because of this, the migrants coming in say, well, wait a minute, you signed the Hague Convention on this or the international agreement on that, And aren't you contradicting yourselves? Aren't you being hypocritical? Isn't this hypocrisy? And she, in fact, terms this hypocrisy costs, that the people who suddenly can take a few people in suddenly think, oh, my God, it's not a few people. It's 1,000, it's 10,000, it's 100,000. And in fact, in her book, at one point, she says that one migrant is a tragedy, 10 migrants is a novelty, and 100 migrants are trouble. So it's if you look at her book, and especially look at the section on Korea, where you get non-governmental organizations involved, especially those with a religious cast, you can get people out of the country and try to move them into South Korea and into China. And it failed there because the Chinese said, no, no, no. These are economic migrants. They're not fleeing anything except their own economic situation in North Korea. And the South Koreans, who welcomed them at first, saw that these people were not philosopher kings, but in a sense, troublemakers. And they said, well, we can't take care of 1,000 or 2,000 people. How are we going to take care of more? So let's block this. And that's what happened. But it seems to be working very, very well in Europe.
That's right. China didn't cooperate with that, and they blocked that, according to her book. Is this emptying out of one country and then flooding another country with people? This effectively is a destabilization device, right? I mean, how how has this affected Europe?
Well, it's just turned it upside down. You got, for example, I remember seeing a press conference given by a city councilman in Munich who said to the city council there, look, we've got 50,000 migrants in Munich alone. They're housed in a sports stadium, and they're going to have to sleep on the ground because we don't have 50,000 air mattresses to put under them. They were housed in sport halls in a small village of maybe 10,000 people east of Stuttgart. They were put up in camps in France, and they've taken over Calais and are expanding in other places. And the French government is having fits because people are trying to hitch rides on trucks crossing through the Channel Tunnel to get into Britain, where they think the benefits are better. So it's a terrible situation there. There are places where the students in a public school, Muslim students, won't sit at a table with Christian girls. And they have this cross-cultural problem that they can't seem to break. And yet they seem to believe, the German government does, that everything is hunky-dory, that, well, yeah, there are some issues and some irritations, but things are getting better. And it's not the case. It's all over Europe. People are raising serious questions and are questioning their governments, which ignore them. There's one case, and I think it's Denmark, where a guy brought his two wives and a dozen children in, and he claimed he was too sick to work and he was too sick to study Danish, and has recently gotten permission to bring another wife and eight more children over. And the government is having fits, saying, well, what is this? This guy is costing the taxpayer a fantastic amount of money every day for all of these people, and he can't work. So it's you have violence, you have inability to adjust. Initially it was things like Muslims that had clashed with drunken Oktoberfest goers in Munich, or the more ultra-conservative of them seemed to think that some of the German girls, to their taste, were too skimpily clad, and they wanted them to cover up. And this, again, brought more tension, and it snowballed from there and into major issues.
You point out in your book that no European leader will state publicly that the migrations are caused by the U.S. wars.
Exactly. They all talk about, oh, we have to accommodate these poor people who are fleeing the tyranny of Syria. I, in fact, had a guy who had bought the German edition of my book talking to his sister, and he had sent me an email saying that his sister thought this was all conspiracy theory, that Bashar al-Assad was a monster, he was a devil incarnate, that the United States really has to be supported in its fight against terrorism all around the world. And anybody who questioned this was somebody who really didn't understand what was going on. And I think there's an awful lot of that. And the people, for the most part, see through a lot of this, a good bit of it at least, and see that the Americans and their wars are creating this problem. But no politician says this. Nobody comes out and says this is a major issue. This is tied to religion, ethnicity. This is tied to culture. And it all comes about because the United States and the European countries, now that they're part of the forever war, have destroyed Afghanistan, have destroyed Iraq, have destroyed Libya, and have destroyed Syria. And if you stop the wars and use the money that is being used to prosecute the wars from NATO and the NATO budgets of the NATO members and use this for something productive, like send these people back home, have a Marshall Plan to repair the destroyed infrastructure, then you would have something that would be useful. And these people could learn a trade. They could learn a language besides Farsi or something like this and be made better off. But instead, we're destroying their homelands. The real losers in all this actually are the migrants, because they essentially have been dehoused, deculturalized, destabilized, and destroyed. They're being forced to fit into German society and French society and then Danish society. And what about their own society? They had a perfectly good society back home, and they've been driven out of it. So everyone loses, not only the Europeans, but the migrants.
I'm speaking with former U.S. diplomat, attorney, and author Michael Springman. Today's show, Migration as Asymmetric Warfare. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. In terms of the mass migrations into Europe, you talk quite a bit in your book, of course, about the outside help that has facilitated moving these, what are, I guess at this point, millions of people into the European Union. You talk about subsidies for smartphones, travel, the information highway, groups encouraging people to migrate. I guess it must have been a year or more ago that I saw all of these pictures on Twitter of these huge columns of people streaming across the countryside. And I think maybe one of them, this column of people was trying to enter Hungary. These were massive amounts of people. So it had to be organized, right?
Exactly. I mean, they just don't suddenly wake up one morning and say, well, gee, I'm going from Damascus to Dusseldorf. And it's a long way to go. If you're walking on foot, it's a good 2,500 miles, if not more. So, yeah, I mean, it was organized. It was organized, I believe, by the intelligence services, by these NGOs fronting for the intelligence services, and by people in the various countries. I think there was a column that marched from Hungary into Austria, and they were led by Syrians and Iraqis. So it's a very well-organized thing. You just can't go from the Middle East on foot to Central Europe. You require help. You don't have topographical maps. You somehow get these smartphones, which are not cheap in the region. I looked at prices in Syria, for example, and the phones they use to navigate with to find the smuggler in Turkey and find his price, well, you know, these are costs as much there as they do here. And, yeah, maybe you can get a cheaper one or a used one or a rehabbed one or something like this. But still, where do the unaccompanied children get them? And if you're leaving the country with nothing but you can carry in your own two hands, where do you get all the money to do this? The average wage in Damascus is something like $50 a month.
You write that, quote, U.S. social media organizations provide the wherewithal for the migrants overrunning Europe. The companies, particularly Facebook, provide a wealth of information to the illegals. What sort of information is provided to migrants on Facebook?
Just about anything you want. If you want to get a map, you can get it from Facebook. If you want the price of a smuggler someplace, you can get it on Facebook. If you want a weather report, you can get it from Facebook. George Soros is supposed to have had an app for Facebook to help him navigate the migrant routes. So just about anything you want, you can get electronically. And the first thing these people do when they hit a country is say, where can I get my cell phone charged? And how do I connect to the local Wi-Fi network?
And where did Facebook come from?
According to Wayne Mattson, the journalist, he believes it came from the CIA, from their technology company, Inqtel, I-N-Q-T-E-L, that provided the seed money for Facebook to Mort Zuckerberg, who, according to an article that was sent me, likes what Merkel is doing with the migrants, and he had met personally with her and thanked her for all of her help.
And you also emailed me that Twitter is refusing to advertise your book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was astonished. Apparently, it's the long arm of Merkel and freedom of speech, or lack thereof. I had gotten these ads from Twitter to sign up and promote something. And I thought, well, I wasn't getting anywhere with Facebook. I had 13,000 likes on my first book in a couple of months. And I have not even 50 on my second book in a couple of months. So I figured I would try Twitter. And essentially, I made the ad with the picture of the cover of the book and the line for the background on the European migrant Tsuzami. See my website, michaelspringman2ns.com, and put that up. They approved it. They charged me for it. And then the next day I got an email saying, we've taken it down because this is hate speech. And I have repeatedly emailed them, asking them to clarify what their definition of hate speech is, because the picture of a book cover and directions to a website hardly can constitute hate speech.
Did you get a response from them?
Not at all.
What is Antifa and the Black Bloc?
Well, those are people who are supposedly against anti-fascism, and they define fascism as anybody opposing the migrant wave. The Black Bloc is a kind of a undercover organization that does many of the protest movements against Pegida and the Alternative for Germany, for example, who are demonstrating against the migrant wave and demanding that something be done to take their country back. And they simply go and march and create an uproar and say, look, the fascists started. These people are bad people. They're terrible people. Let's do something about them. And in one case, a week after the New Year's Eve riots of 2015 in Cologne, wherein the government of the city and the Lord Mayor Henriette Raker refused to turn water cannons loose on the people who were attacking the women across from the train station and the cathedral. They turned the water cannons a week later on a Pegida march, protesting what was not done to protect the people the previous week. So there's a link, I think, between people who claim to be anti-fascists and the various city governments and then the state and federal governments in Germany.
You've mentioned how the George Soros-sponsored General European University is helping the migrations, that students are offering translation assistance, etc. What about the help with Wi-Fi? Now, you write that Wi-Fi and mobile phone charging stations have been set up along migration routes going north into Europe. Who is responsible for that?
Well, it's Soros. It's the Belgrade Center for Human Rights, which is an aid group in Serbia. And Cisco Systems, the big computer software company, is also involved. They have kicked in a couple of $100,000 for this. Cisco donated a total of $745,000 to organizations aiding in the refugee crisis, including $630,000 worth of equipment to support these deployments and $200,000 in grant funding to NGO partners NetHope and Mercy Corps. As Mercy Corps, has the close relations with the American government, always seem to be operating in war zones and had their people arrested for espionage.
You write that the United Nations Refugee Agency distributed thousands of SIM cards in refugee camps in Jordan.
Right. Yeah.
When was that?
This would have been around 2015, I think.
So it was 2015, really, let's say the latter half of 2015 and into 2016, where the bulk of these migrations into Europe took place. What is going on now? Is it still happening?
It is. It seemed to have fallen off the radar for a while, and then in the last couple of weeks, I've seen more and more news articles on RT talking about the waves of migrants are now aimed at Italy and Spain. In the past, Italy had been the target because it's just across the water from Libya, and Libya had just been destabilized, so people moved from there to Italy. Then the movement shifted to the Balkans, and then it seems to be shifting back to Italy and Spain because Spain is just across the Straits of Gibraltar. I mean, what is it, 17 miles wide, I think. So, yeah, they stormed the Spanish enclave of Ceuta in the edge of Morocco, and now they're taking boats across the Straits of Gibraltar to make it to Spain and then claim asylum in Europe.
Could you talk about how the destabilization of Europe is part of U.S. geopolitical strategy? Why would the U.S. want Europe destabilized?
Well, a united Europe, an organized Europe, would be a really strong economic and political competitor to the United States. An organized, developed, coherent, unified Europe, in particular with Germany in it, with its technology and know-how and education, would be the logical partner for Russia with a vast amount of natural resources. Put those two together, and you have no longer a unipolar world. You have a multipolar world, and the strength of the other pole is far greater than the Americans. And if the Americans can somehow disrupt this, if the Americans can somehow destabilize all of Europe, make the European Union disintegrate, or become not Charlie de Gaulle's European Europe, but an Americanized Europe, then you would have a greater control and the ability to end any kind of political or economic competition for the United States.
Right. So a lot of this policy of the U.S., of course, is to separate Europe from Russia at all costs.
Exactly.
You write that Merkel, like Obama, bases her immigration policy on a globalist view of the world. Former Secretary of State John Kerry warned Americans that we must prepare ourselves for a, quote, borderless world. How is it that nation states can provide citizenship and protect individual rights and liberties in ways that a borderless world cannot?
Well, it's really simple. There's us and then there's them, and the us government controls the borders. It provides security, it provides soldiers, it provides policemen, and it grants citizenship and the benefits of citizenship, such as voting. And if you don't have any borders, who's to say who you are or where you're from? And why should someone who is a stranger here from somewhere else control our policies and dictate what we can say and what we can do and what we can read? And that's the thing. In the end, nation states were created because the village, because the guy out in the fields and the farmlands couldn't protect themselves. You needed strong central government of one kind or another, whether it started out as the knight in his castle or the duke and his dukedom with his men at arms and his knights to providing order and control and keeping out people who wanted to disrupt the order and control. And if you don't have a nation state with an army and a police force behind it, you're at the mercy of whoever there is out there. It's basically anarchy.
And how is it that the breaking down of nation state structures allows American corporate pillaging?
Well, they don't have to fight the large government, the strong government of France or Germany or Italy or Sweden or somewhere to get their genetically modified grains and genetically modified animals into the countries. If the countries are weak, if you have no borders, if you have constant turmoil in the lands in Europe, you can fish in troubled waters and pretty much get what you want. It's kind of like a disorganized city where gangs rule, and if you got the gangs on your side, then you can do anything you want. And in the case of American policy with genetically modified milk, for example. I remember being in Germany, and the Germans hated this and didn't want it into the country. The Americans kept saying, but it's good for you. And they said, no, it's not good for us. And in Europe, for the most part, you have to mark something that's being sold as whether it's genetically modified or not, unlike the United States. So you can break this down, you can use the power of the United States against the weakened powers of a borderless Europe to get what you want.
I believe you have written that terrorist attacks and migrant waves are directly related. Can we consider them instruments of U.S. policy?
Yes, I think so. I mean, RT asked me at one point a year or so ago, before I started writing the book, did I believe that there were 5,000 terrorists concealed in these waves of migrants? And I said, well, I disputed the number. But I said, definitely, you can say that terrorists are being concealed in this, and they're in hiding, and they simply have these peculiar passports, and they can move into the continent and do what they want to do. Qatar, for example, at one point had been printing Syrian passports that were, you know, obviously as good as the real Pekoi. The French government prior to 2011 had been making passports for Syria, and who's to say they've stopped making them, making sure they go to their special friends. I mentioned earlier that people were counterfeiting these passports, and the counterfeits were almost indistinguishable from the real thing. So, the people are being fed into Europe with fake documents to do whatever they're being directed to do.
Michael Springman, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with J. Michael Springman. Today's show has been Migration as Asymmetric Warfare. Michael Springman is a former diplomat in the State Department's Foreign Service with postings to Germany, India, Saudi Arabia, and the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in Washington, D.C. He was chief of the non-immigrant visa section in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia from 1987 to 1989. He is the author of Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, An Insider's View, and his latest, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb. In June 2004, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee granted him its Pro Bono Attorney of the Year Award. He is the published author of several articles on national security themes, particularly those dealing with relations between the CIA and the Department of State. He is now an attorney in private practice. Visit his website at michaelspringman.com. That's Michael, SPRINGMANN.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? Wake up and take control of your own cipher and be on the lookout.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, filmmaker John Pilger shows what's really going on with U.S. policy with North Korea, China, and Russia, and why Hillary Clinton lost the election. I hope you'll stay tuned. Two voices apart from my own grace New World Notes today. The deeper voice with the Australian accent belongs to the documentary filmmaker John Pilger. Pilger has been a consistent and effective critic of U.S., British, and Australian policy, and the ruling elites that the policy serves. So, don't look for his films on American public TV, let alone commercial TV. In fact, his films are shown extensively on British and Australian TV, where diversity of opinion and occasional criticism of government policy is still permitted in the media, unlike here. Someone suggested that we should give our First Amendment to England. They don't have one, and after all, we're not using ours for anything. Today, Pilger focuses on U.S. foreign policy, which leads naturally enough to a discussion of Mr. Trump, Mrs. Clinton, and the 2016 presidential election. Spoiler alert, Pilger sees both candidates as loyal servants of the ruling class, anti-democratic to the core, with Hillary Clinton being the more dangerous of the two. I'm bound to say I quite agree. Pilger is interviewed by Cindy Sheehan. You may recall her as the mother of a U.S. soldier killed in our Iraq War in 2004. That turned Cindy into a peace activist. Over the years, her perspective broadened. She came to understand that the fight for peace requires a fight against injustice and inequality of several kinds. Sheehan is a good interviewer. That is, she has enough sense to give Pilger a good prompt, then get out of the way and let him talk for several minutes. Supposedly, she's interviewing him about his latest documentary film, The Coming War on China. In fact, Pilger gives a wide-ranging talk about China, North Korea, Russia, the Middle East, the 1%, and the corruption of Hillary Clinton. Speaking on May 23, 2017, here is John Pilger.
Well, you say you grew up, so did I, during the first Cold War. I mean, we're back into another Cold War. It's not exactly the same, but it feels like that at times. And the two principal adversaries in the Cold War, manufactured adversaries, were Russia and China. China is rather difficult for the United States to present as a total enemy, whereas Russia is always in American demonology and mythology being the enemy. It's not the enemy, of course, but it's easier to demonize. Whereas China is America's biggest trading partner. China has also risen to become the world's second biggest economic power. And what really bothers the United States is not that the Chinese are about to attack the U.S. or unleash a war against the U.S., but that its economic power is challenging that of the U.S., the dominance of the U.S. And so the United States has really devoted much of its long-term strategic thinking to attempting to constrain China. There are 400 U.S. bases encircling China.
Right.
One of the most secretive and biggest bases in the world is in the Marshall Islands in the Pacific. It was set up in 1968 to combat Red China, and it's now a Star Wars base, and most of its configuration is at China. Now, this not meaning to suggest that China and the United States are about to go to war, but it does present us with a situation that we saw a great deal during the first Cold War, and that is an atmosphere is created of suspicion and misinformation between nuclear powers. And that means that war and nuclear war can break out by mistake or accident. It's very interesting at the moment with Trump because there's a seesaw going on. One moment somebody is an enemy, the next moment they're a friend.
Right.
There's Donald Trump sitting down to dinner with President Xi of China, enjoying the presidential chocolate cake while he tells him that he's fired 50-odd Tomahawk missiles at Syria, that was clearly meant to demonstrate that the United States is still the top dog as far as military power is concerned. I'm sure President Xi took the message. So the Cold War is not as black and white as it appeared to us back in the 1950s and 60s and 70s into the 80s. It's much more of perceived threats that really are transcendent. I mean, it's what is this all about? It's about the United States losing its position as the tough guy on the block, not in terms of military power, but in terms of economic power. China is looking behind it through Eurasia. It's just conduct an extraordinary conference in which it's laid out plans for something like $900 billion worth of development along its old Silk Road, so mass transit to Europe, so that it can trade across the great steppes and the continent of Europe. This is all very 21st century. It's about development. It's about countries flexing their economic muscles. It makes the United States seem almost 19th century. They don't wear the pith helmets.
Right.
It's rattling at sabers. But that presents us with great dangers. Now, Trump has just been in the Middle East. Trump is still in the Middle East. He's now, as we speak, I think, in Israel. But he's really unctuous speech in Saudi Arabia to one of the world's most primitive regimes was really about carving out America's territory all over again, of reminding the world and reminding China, of reminding this great economic power that depends on the Middle East for most of its oil, as do the other countries of Asia. He was saying to the world, particularly to China, this is our patch. Come and get the oil, but don't interfere here. So these kind of grand gestures are going on at the moment. But again, they bring with them very considerable risk, because always when there are military forces involved and nuclear military forces, that means danger. As we've seen in the tragedies in Iraq and in Afghanistan, the violence that we've seen already in this century, this new century, have been really about posturing.
Right. Well, let's talk about recently the tension that Trump has escalated all around North Korea. I believe, and I'm sure that that is more a posturing towards China.
Yeah. Well, you know, North Korea is a, quote, problem, unquote, that could have been solved a long time ago, such as the way we're trained to perceive other societies. It's meant to be some particularly insane, deranged society. It's nothing of the kind. It has a very closeted regime, but there's no question that, in my mind anyway, that North Korea would have been attacked by the United States had it not possessed nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
That point has been made very clearly by the fact that it hasn't been attacked. What North Korea wants is a peace treaty for a war that ended in 1953, a war in which all its major cities were razed to the ground by the United States. There's never been anything like it, and that includes the Second World War. North Korea was absolutely obliterated, and yet it was North Korea that opposed the Japanese, the Koreans in the North, that is, who opposed the Japanese during the Second World War. And so North Korea is a country that actually is almost begging for peace. A peace treaty with North Korea would end this standoff between the United States and the regime in Pyongyang. It would almost certainly bring together North and South Korea. Now, the Clinton administration did negotiate with the North Koreans on nuclear power, on nuclear development. North Korea agreed to stop processing plutonium, and this was going along a very positive route until George W. Bush came into power, right, and stopped it. And the bad guy was back on the block. North Korea was the demon again. Trump has made him the demon again. Of course, if there was a peace treaty, which is all North Korea wants, that would mean there'd be no need for 50,000 U.S. troops along the 38th parallel in Korea. And that's what all this is about. There's always a kind of, Cindy, there's always an official truth and an unofficial truth. That's the unofficial truth. A peace treaty would mean that America would have to get out of Korea, but it would make the rest of the world, and especially Korea, a much safer place. And as you rightly point out, much of this is aimed at China. The U.S. is installed in South Korea, its sort of vassal state, what is called a THAAD anti-nuclear defense system, which is in fact just a series of missiles that can destroy China's defenses before it has an opportunity to defend itself. So it's very aggressive. It's a very aggressive thing to do, and it's right on China's doorstep. The background to North Korea and this threat to China is really very, very important to understand, and it's something about which there's almost a willful ignorance.
Try talking about North Korea, Russia, China, Syria. Try talking about Syria. And recently, the United States, the State Department just accused Assad of having crematoriums. Then they had to say, oh, well, that wasn't right. But once you accuse Assad of having crematoriums, that's all the people remember.
That's right. It's very interesting because it's what I would call a propaganda blitz.
Mm-hmm.
So if you blitz a subject, let's say Syria has crematoria, Syria has used chemical weapons against its own people, Syria has slaughtered several hundred thousand people. If you keep up this monologue, this monotone of misinformation, of half-truths. No one is suggesting, of course, that the Syrian government is a pleasant regime, but you never hear that it is probably the protector of the most multi-ethnic society in the Middle East, a society that would be obliterated if the fanatics of ISIS and al-Nusra and al-Qaeda, which are backed by the United States, directly and indirectly were allowed to take over Syria. The propaganda blitz is to suggest this is a uniquely evil government in the way, as we've just been talking about, the propaganda blitz is to present North Korea as deranged, as mad. Here's a bit of his particular human insanity is concentrated here and there. It's a kind of use of propaganda that allows no dissent. And what really has happened in free countries in the West in recent years is the diminishing of dissent, of real dissent. There are very few mainstream media outlets that would have the kind of conversation we are having now. It is slogans. It is this propaganda blitz. The Russians. The Russians invaded Ukraine. Well, no, they didn't, actually.
Right.
But that's propaganda blitz, and so on and so forth.
Well, like here in the U.S., it's just accepted. Now it's just an accepted truth that Russia hacked the U.S. elections to install Donald Trump in favor of Donald Trump. And that's like the only reason Hillary Clinton lost is because Russia, Russia, Russia. It's just repeated like it's just like you were talking about. It's just the truth. Because you know what? 16 intelligence agencies in the United States said it was so. And we both know that those intelligence agencies have never lied. So talk about that, because I think this leads into Julian Assange and how he had always said it wasn't a hack, it was a leak.
Yeah, well, it's the best example, Cindy, because it reminds me of, you know, was it before the Second World War, there was a famous radio broadcast by Orson Welles in which he read from H.G. Wells, The War of the Worlds. I think I may have this right. But he did it so effectively that he frightened everybody, frightened the nation. And I don't know, was it Roosevelt had to comment on it or something? My knowledge peters out there. But it caused something of a national panic. Well, that the Russians are coming, or the Russians have given us Donald Trump. We hate Donald Trump, A. B, that's because the Russians did it. They interfered. All this is nonsense, beginning to end. The 16 agencies produced not a shred of proof. It used the words, I believe, it is in our opinion, and so on. They used a kind of sophistry. Anybody reading their reports, so-called reports, would see they have no evidence. And that's really a shocking indictment of, first of all, the media, but I have to say of people who accept that as well. You talked about your compatriots there accepting that Russia had interfered. It's the kind of pre-Enlightenment ignorance that great religious power relied upon. And it's willful. That's the point. It's imposed. Of course, the unofficial truth is that the United States has actively interfered in the Russian electoral process since the end of the Soviet Union and all but installed their own man in the Kremlin, Boris Yeltsin. And the reason that Vladimir Putin is demonized is that he and his government, for all its failings, he and his government have given back a dignity and a pride and a nationalism to Russia, and Russia is now independent. And really this comes back to all these countries, North Korea, China, Iran, Russia, and the others, not a terribly long list, their crimes are that they are independent. Independent, and that's intolerable. So this nonsense about Russia blaming Hillary Clinton. I mean, Hillary Clinton, if Hillary Clinton had been elected, it is my view that it wouldn't just be Donald Trump's 59 missiles fired at Syria. There'd be a whole shooting war on firing at another country.
Right.
She presented a much greater threat than Trump ever did. And yet to say that, particularly on liberal circles, I wrote an article which truthout.com refused to publish because they comment, it was inaccurate because I'd drawn an equivalence between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Well, in many aspects, there was an equivalence, and there is an equivalence. In fact, I would say that on their records alone, Hillary Clinton was by far the most aggressive and potentially dangerous president, much more so than Trump. Now, that is anathema. That's almost something that just shouldn't be spoken. And this whole idea of the Russians stopping Hillary Clinton, a candidate who abused the electorate, called people, irredeemables.
Deplorables.
Deplorables, and abused the people that she was expecting would vote for her. So that's propaganda. That's a propaganda blitz. The Russia is responsible for Hillary Clinton's defeat is a propaganda blitz, probably the most perfect example of it.
There's much evidence that the Democratic National Committee colluded with each other and with the corporate media in the United States to throw the election to her. And there was much evidence that the other candidate that was running against her, Bernie Sanders, was cheated out of the nomination. And that brings us to Julian Assange and the leaked emails.
Well, yes. Last October, I interviewed Julian, and I asked him about the leaked emails, the Clinton emails. And I put it to him, did they come from Russia? And his answer was they did not come from Russia. And I know that they did not come from Russia. And there's no evidence that they came from Russia. Almost certainly they came from within the Democratic National Committee, though I can't confirm that.
Right.
But what these emails did was cast a really glaring light on Hillary Clinton. Here was, as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton was doing deals with the Saudis and the Qataris and the other Gulf states, doing arms deals with them while the Gulf states were donating, so-called, giving money to the Clinton Foundation, and which would, of course, be money for the Clinton campaign. And in one of these, the Podesta emails, named after John Podesta, from John Podesta, of course, her early campaign manager, had said, that makes clear that she was supporting these Gulf states knowing how much they were underwriting ISIS. So the focal point of terrorism, so-called, in the Middle East was being underwritten by the allies of Hillary Clinton, who made her a beneficiary of their great wealth. That was really the story about all those emails. It was extraordinary corruption on many levels. Now, I don't think that, because it wasn't known across the United States, would have caused her political demise. She certainly contributed mostly to that. But that was Hillary Clinton, who was hoping to be the next president of the United States.
Well, she also skipped campaigning in what they call in the United States the Rust Belt, where Donald Trump did very well. And to me, looking at it, because of Russia or whatever. It was because people needed jobs. They felt like they had lost their security. And not only that, but they saw, rightly so, saw Hillary Clinton as part of the problem, as part of the establishment that brought us here.
Well, they analyzed it correctly. The Democrats, the people who have masqueraded for many years as representing ordinary people in the United States, were in fact not. On the contrary, they were representing the interests that opposed ordinary people in the United States. And that, I mean, we know that. That was true of Obama, and it was true of the Bill Clinton administration. But it was probably more true of Hillary Clinton, that she represented these hugely powerful interests. She represented an elite at a time when I think most people, for all the misinformation that they have to deal with, understood very clearly, and this is true in Europe, but certainly true in this country, in Britain and other countries, that their problems lay with this hierarchy of politics, that it was the elite, an elite, the so-called 1%, if you like, protecting these elite interests that were their real political and social adversaries. She was the embodiment of that.
Oh, yeah, clearly, obviously. Just tell the listeners how they can get more information about your film and about your writings.
Okay, thank you. Well, my website, www.johnpilger.com, has all but two of the 60 documentary films I've made available free to watch. So that's a resource I think that many of your listeners will be interested in. It doesn't have yet my latest film, The Coming War on China, but that's available in the United States through Bullfrog Films. They have a website. I think it's bullfrogfilms.com. Film is available from there. So due to the wonders of the internet, all these things are online. Very nice speaking to you, Cindy.
Well,
always
you,
an honor and always a pleasure.
A fascinating discussion of the truth behind American foreign policy. And a reminder about President Trump. Lacking though he may be in judgment, knowledge, wit, and taste, he's pretty much correct about fake news. Or, as Pilger calls it, the propaganda blitz. With that cheerful thought, I bid you adieu. Thanks to The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan for the audio, which I have edited for New World Notes. Find an archive of our programs on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On today's show, you're going to hear a speech given by Dr. David Ray Griffin in Seattle after the 9/11 Commission report came out. Dr. David Ray Griffin has written over 10 books on 9/11, one of them being the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. On today's show, you'll hear some of those omissions and distortions. Dr. David Ray Griffin is a retired professor. He worked at Claremont School of Theology for 31 years as a professor of philosophy of religion and theology, and he's authored or edited over 25 books. If you're new to the 9/11 truth movement or want to know what the real evidence is of what really happened on 9/11, a good place to start would be to read Dr. David Ray Griffin's books on 9/11, starting with The New Pearl Harbor and The New Pearl Harbor Revisited. As many of the listeners may know, Dr. David Ray Griffin has spoken several times in Connecticut on his 9/11 research. He's working on a new book, which should be out sometime in 2017. So let's begin. The speech you're about to hear is called Truth in Politics. And here he is, Dr. David Ray Griffin.
With regard to our topic today, Truth in Politics, some people may wonder, people maybe outside this room, but is there anything in the 9/11 Commission report that is untrue? And now that I've finished the book, my big question is, can I find a true sentence in the book? That may sound extreme, but if you don't take it too literally, and if you realize a sentence is a part of a paragraph, which is a part of an argument, then it is hard to find any truth there. And so what I'm going to do this afternoon is just go through and give you some examples. One thing to understand about the report is that, you know, we quite often name commissions after the leader. So we had the Rumsfeld Commission on the space program, so on. So quite often this is called the Cain Commission, but it should be called the Cain-Zelikow Commission. Because the executive director is Philip Zelikow. He was a member of the Bush 1 administration. He got to know Condoleezza Rice very well there. They both served on the National Security Council. When they were between administrations during the Clinton years, they wrote a book together. When the Bush 2 administration was coming into power, she brought him on to help with the transition. And then he was appointed to the Foreign Advisory Board. So he is essentially a member of the Bush White House. And yet, as executive director, he ran the commission. He had a staff of 70-some. He assigned them which topics were worth looking into and which ones were not. He assigned when people would come and say, I want to testify to the commission, I have something important to say. He would decide who would take that testimony, and so on. Let me give you an example, just one tiny example of how important that is. There's a new book out by Peter Lance called Cover Up. And Peter, good patriot that he is, went to testify because he had some important information about Ramzi Youssef. Remember the masterminded the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. He was also the mastermind of the Bojinka project that they discovered in Manila. And he also was the one who came up with the planes idea of using planes for weapons. So he is the mastermind. Peter went to give testimony. And his testimony was going to contradict some of the things that showed up that were in the prosecution's case in 1996 when they prosecuted Ramzi Youssef. Who took Peter Lance's testimony? Dietrich Schnell, one of the two prosecutors of that event, of that trial. So that is an example of how the executive director could skew. And Peter said he got a mole inside the commission, somebody who was very unhappy on the staff, who was unhappy with the way things were going. And they would meet, and he would tell Peter what was going on. And he said that Zelikow just runs the whole commission, that there are these leadership teams, and six out of the seven teams, he said, are completely controlled by Zelikow. Only one team, run by John Farmer, was not, and they were butting heads all the time. There are other examples, like at the commission report, people would say, tell us about the war games. And they would ask the commissioners, why didn't you deal with the war games? And the commissioners said, oh, well, we were told that was unimportant. Well, by whom were they told? Uh-huh. So you essentially have the 9/11 commission. It's the White House investigating itself. And furthermore, as Peter points out, the staff, you know, you think, oh, well, they got a staff there. It's a bunch of people who know how to do research. They probably got, you know, university students and so on. No. Ex-FBI, ex-CIA, ex-Department of Justice, nine members from the Department of Justice. Ashcroft, yeah. So they've got their friends back on there. So when you wonder, why are no names named? Got people on there protecting their friends, protecting their institutions that they're still proud of, or they want to be, have the public to have a good point. So from the very beginning, this was a doomed commission. It was not a commission to get the truth. Once you realize that, these things won't shock you quite as much. But even then, even knowing that, I was still shocked at the number of omissions and the audacity of some of the distortions. So let me go through some of these. Starting right out on the very first pages, they start telling you about the hijackers. What they don't tell you, and they give you the names, and in the middle of the book you can see their pictures. What they don't tell you is that at least six of those men are still alive. Some of them have, like Waleed al-Shira, walked into the embassy and said, here I am, I'm not dead. And some of them were interviewed by the BBC and London newspapers. And nevertheless, they're in there. And this Waleed al-Shira, they have him on Flight 11. And they say, we believe he's one of the ones who stabbed some of the people who were stabbed. Just a total disregard of well-known facts. Just omit that there's any problem with the identity of the hijackers. Likewise, they fail to mention, Daniel Hopsicker has written a whole book about Muhammad Atta, shown he was not a devout Muslim. You know, the image we have, here are these radical fundamentalist Muslims. They're ready to meet their maker. Atta loved alcohol, pork, and prostitutes. And the commission says, we're puzzled. Why did these guys go to Las Vegas? We've not found any credible reason. Well, they loved lap dances, you know. Another hijacker, alleged hijacker, is Hani Hanjour. And they tell us he was chosen to fly Flight 77, the one that was going to hit the Pentagon, because he was their best pilot. Hani Hanjour could not fly any kind of airplane. He would go up in his lessons, and the next time the guy wouldn't go up with him. He says, you can't fly. He was known as a horrible pilot, even with a little plane. And yet he was alleged to fly this Boeing 757 and make this amazing spiral come down and come in at ground level 400 miles an hour into the Pentagon. The best pilots in the world, some of them have looked at that and said, I don't think I could do that. Hani Hanjour could not fly. This one they do mention. It's a funny thing. They mention this and then they just ignore it. And they have President Bush and Mays, you know, boy, this was some pilot, you know. The flight manifest. We've never publicly seen flight manifests that show that any of the... So it's not just the six. We don't know that any of the 19 men named were actually on these flights. None of this is mentioned. It's not mentioned and refuted. It's just not mentioned. So that's why I call it omissions. And some people call it the 9/11 Omission Commission. Let me give another example. World Trade Center. They hardly discuss the question of these enormous buildings coming down. They don't discuss any of the problems. One problem is, never before in history have steel-framed high-rise buildings collapsed because of fire. Now, some people say, well, when just fire, these big planes hit them. Well, people who have looked at this said that's insignificant. Besides, no plane hit building number 7, which is a 47-story skyscraper. And it came down also. Furthermore, even if you were going to have fire weaken a building, it would have to be enormous fires. They would have to be very hot, not ordinary hydrocarbon fires that you get from kerosene, which is what jet fuel is. And they would have to be very long-lasting. These fires didn't last. The South Tower came down in 57 minutes. There's an enormous amount of steel in a 110-story building that is steel-framed inside and outside. And yet they're telling us these. Now, the only thing they mention here, they mentioned that South Tower collapsed in 10 seconds. Can you imagine how fire would bring down a 110-story building in free fall speed? And that's what it is. Also, the wrong tower collapsed first. The North Tower was hit first. And so if it's fire that's bringing it down, it takes a while for the fire to heat up the steel. The North Tower should have collapsed first. The South Tower also had a much smaller fire because the plane hit it at the angle, at the corner, and so most of the fuel went outside and burned up. So that enormous fireball you see, you say, boy, what an enormous fire. Well, yeah, for about 15 seconds. And it's burned up, and so there's not much fuel to keep the fire going in the South Tower. And yet, it collapses within 57 minutes. One of the places where you just know they're absolutely lying and cheating is they give you an account that makes it sound plausible that these towers could have come down. They tell you that in the core of each building was a hollow shaft that was just filled with elevators and staircases. Yeah, and 47 massive steel columns. That's what the World Trade, these buildings were all about. This was this unique structure at the time. These 47 massive steel things going up into the air. So massive at the bottom. So even if you accepted the official theory, which is a pancake theory, that somehow the connectors between the columns in the middle and then the peripheral beams around the building, somehow those snapped and then the floors came down and that floor was so heavy it hit the net and it just went down. Can you imagine that happening in 10 seconds? And even if it did, just like if in the old records, when the records fell on the spindle, and those of you who are old enough to remember those, the spindle's still there. So why aren't those 47 towers still sticking up in the air, but the pictures show they totally collapse. You have something that's no more than 3 stories high. I mean, just total dishonesty to deny the existence of those massive columns. And then they don't even mention that building number 7 collapsed. There's not a word about it. Everybody admits there is no explanation for why building number 7 collapsed. In most cities, this would have been the biggest building, 47 stories high. It can be ignored only because it was next to the towers. And FEMA says, they come up with this lame explanation of how this building came down. They said, the only explanation we can come up with has a very low probability of occurrence. But there's no answer. So they, rather than telling you, like an honest report would, we're surprised, we're puzzled why building number 7 collapsed. There's no good answer. They just don't even mention that it collapsed. They don't tell you that Larry Silverstein, the owner virtually of the building and the builder of it, said on a PBS report, well, at a certain point, the fire chief and I got together and we said, you know, there's been so much loss of life, let's not take any chances, and we decided to pull it.
And the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull.
Pull it is the slang for bringing it down by controlled demolition. So he admits it in public. It's well known. It's mentioned in any, like my book and other books and all the books that people sent to the commission, assuming they wanted to know the truth. And they don't mention, they don't bring in Larry Silverstein and say, why did you say that? What'd you mean by that? Isn't that what a commission looking for the truth might do? Likewise, Giuliani said, we knew that the towers were going to collapse, so we got the people out of building number 7. How did he know the tower? Buildings have never collapsed before in history. How could have he known the Twin Towers were going to collapse? They didn't ask him that. They treated him as a hero when he comes into the commission. They fell all over themselves, praising Rudy Giuliani as the great hero. So what I'm getting at here, those of you who haven't read it, is that all three collapses were pretty close to classic examples of what they call controlled demolition. When dynamite or some kind of explosives are placed throughout the building at all the crucial points, and then they put them on a computer and they bring them down in certain order, and therefore the building comes straight down, so it doesn't fall on these other buildings, and they come down in virtually free fall speed. And that's what happened here. All three buildings. You can see them on all sorts of places on the website. You don't see them on TV anymore. They showed them the first night, and Dan Rather, you know, bless his soul, comes right out and blurts out the truth. He says, boy, that looks just like controlled demolition. The 9/11 Commission also does not tell you that Marvin Bush, the president's brother, and their cousin, Ward Walker, were the principals of the company that was in charge of security for the World Trade Center. They don't... All sorts of coincidences here. They also don't tell you that there were many reports of people who worked in the building saying, you know, we got a shutdown order, so for 3 days we couldn't go in the World Trade Center. There were engineers coming in and out. We didn't know it. Okay, moving right along to the Pentagon. They don't tell you that. They do mention that it was the west wing of the Pentagon that was hit. They don't mention that for terrorists who wanted to really strike a blow at the Pentagon, the west wing was the least likely part to hit. Why? Because all the big brass are in the east wing. That's where Rumsfeld and all the top generals are. Furthermore, the West Wing was being renovated. So it was reinforced so the fire wouldn't spread to the rest of the building. Also, there were very few people there. And so, although it's tragic that 125 people on the ground were killed, several thousand would have been killed if the plane had hit any other... Well, if it had been a plane, we'll come to that later. But even what it was, it would have killed several hundred and maybe thousand if it had been an ordinary place. And also, terrorists would want to kill Pentagon workers. Most of the people killed were civilians who were there working on their renovation. Furthermore, as I said, it was the hardest place of the Pentagon to hit. You've got this huge Pentagon here with acres. All you had to do was fly right into the ceiling, right into the roof, and you would have done... You couldn't have missed. Even Hani Hanjour could have hit it. And all you had to do was hit the East Wing. And, you know, remember how smart these terrorists were? These were masterminds. And yet they didn't know that the West Wing wasn't where you would want to hit. Why don't they just release the videos and show us? You know, there are cameras there, cameras on hotels next door. There's a camera in the gas station across the street. All you have to do is show us the videos and you can prove it was a Boeing 757. No, they didn't show us any. They finally, after Thierry Masson came out with his theory that it wasn't a Boeing but a missile, they released 5 frames that they said proved it. Some people have looked at those frames and said, that's when I became a skeptic because that was not a Boeing, even though they tried to make it look like it. Furthermore, this video that was across the street, within 5 minutes of the attack, the FBI was over there and confiscated it. You would think the FBI would be distraught. Hey, for the first time in history, the Pentagon has been hit. No, they had the presence of mind to get in their cars and drive over there and confiscate the video. We've never seen it. 9/11 Commission, of course, doesn't mention any of this. How could a Boeing, a commercial airliner, attack the Pentagon? Wouldn't you have batteries of missiles surrounding the Pentagon so that any airplane that doesn't have a military transponder radiate friendly, friendly, friendly would be shot down? Of course, that's exactly the situation. And yet, whatever it was that hit the Pentagon goes right through. Batteries are not operating. Then, one of the most dishonest things in the commission report is they actually bring this up. Because one of the criticisms have been these flights that were going to New York, they passed by one of the biggest nuclear plants right along the river there. All they had to do was attack that. That would have caused far more devastation than any of these attacks on the World Trade Center. It would have, killed hundreds of thousands of people, poisoned the area, ruined the economy of the United States, if that's what these terrorists wanted to do, because they hate freedom and democracy. But they didn't. They flew right over and went and hit the World Trade Center. So what does the 9/11 Commission tell you? Well, they have this guy named, they call him KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And they've captured him, they tell us. Well, he's this font of information, and they just say anything they want to, and they say, this is what KSM told us. We have no way of checking this. They just tell us, he was the mastermind, so what he told him was, well, yeah, we thought about hitting a nuclear plant, but, we said, they're probably guarded. They probably have missiles around there. We'd probably get shot down. So let's go hit the Pentagon. It's surely... And I hate to say it, I'm not making this up. So when you hear that this report is the number one bestseller of the year, and also you go on Amazon and look at the reports, the ratings, customer ratings, at least the last time I looked, 9 out of 10 were 5 stars. People are saying, now we know the truth. And yet, this is comic book stuff. When you know what the truth is, you know all these other reports that they've ignored. It's almost comic book writing. No, that's not true. This is true. How do we know it? Well, because KSM told us, or because we have this transcript. But of course, it will be put in the vault for 50 years, and you'll never be able to see it. With the Warren Commission, they published all the supporting documents. Whatever you can say about the Warren Commission, you can say a lot about the Warren Commission. And Max Cleland said, I'm not going to be part of another Warren Commission cover-up. And he wasn't. The president got him a job, another job. And so you got Max Cleland off the commission, and so you got a unified report. They're very proud. We published this without dissent. They just give you all these reports, and yet they in the notes in the back, and these are authoritative, and yet there's nothing that you can go to check these reports because they're in the hands of the FBI or they're in the hands of other people. You can't check out anything they say, unlike the Warren Commission. At least you could see the testimony. Okay, President Bush on 9/11. You would think... we've seen these movies about the Secret Service. These guys are really highly trained. And if there's the slightest danger to the president, they get in front of him. If there's the slightest danger that this route is not good, you change the route, and so on and so on. Here's the president down in Sarasota in the classroom. And, of course, a lot of you have seen that in the Michael Moore movie. And he sits there, and he sits there, and he sits there after they've told him about the second tower. After the first tower was hit, he says, oh boy, what a horrible accident. So they just go on like, oh, this was a little plane and it flew in. But after the second one, there could be no doubt, but America was under a terrorist attack. I mean, given the official story, could be no doubt about that. So why didn't the Secret Service whisk him out of there? Because if these were terrorists and they wanted to attack the symbols of America, what better target than the President of the United States? If Osama bin Laden... I started to say I'm not trying to put ideas in your mind, and I see I don't have to. Yeah. So the Secret Service would have immediately said, we're next. We're going to be targeted next. They're there in an empty school. There's no fighter cover over. The president is completely unprotected. So the 9/11 Commission said, well, we asked the Secret Service, why did you let the president stay there another half hour? And they said, well, we thought it would look bad if we got up and ran out of the room. Yeah, well, it would look bad if the President of the United States got murdered on your watch because you didn't do your job, too. But that, and they accepted that. And like the only alternatives were get him up and rush him out of the room, like Cheney said they did to him. Could it be that they think Cheney's more important than Bush? No. Let's not go there. That story about Cheney is probably apocryphal anyway. So, but that's what the Secret Service is supposed to do when there's a real danger. And yet, there was no sign of danger. So they said, well, we didn't want to rush him out of the room. So they left him there for 30 minutes. How about something in between, like, excuse us, the president must leave, he's been called to other duties, and you walk out of the room. So the commission didn't press them on that. They just accepted that answer. And time again, I use that as an illustration, they accept the most, really the silliest answers from these authoritative figures, and very seldom do they press. And the few times they do press, it gets deleted from the final report. And that's the other thing to know about Zelikow. He was the editor. He was in charge of the final report. And so it's pretty consistent. I've only found two or three inconsistencies in the parts of the book that I've read. So it clearly had to be finally one mind who was in charge of this. And he's my candidate.
And again, you were just listening to the first part of a speech called Truth in Politics, given by Dr. David Ray Griffin in Seattle after the 9/11 Commission report was first published. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of this speech. And now I want to tell you about the next film in our Progressive Movie Night series. On June 21st, we'll be showing the film Decade of Deception, which is a video on some of the key speeches and evidence from the 2011 Toronto hearings on 9/11. So again, that's June 21st at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. And just a reminder that 9/11 Wake Up Call shows are archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit 4, so radioforall.net. Once on the site, search under my name, Cheryl, with a C. It's on page 3 of the C's, and the show should pop up in chronological order. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. 50 years later, has the U.S. learned anything from the Newark rebellions? On July 12, 1967, the African-American residents of Newark rebelled, sparked by the beating of a black cab driver by white police officers, and would leave 26 people killed, more than 700 injured, and millions of dollars of property damage, vandalized and burned properties. Joining us are two of my most honored historians, educators, agitators, activist Junius Williams, who served as the chair of the committee celebrating the 350th anniversary of the founding of the city of Newark, the people's lawyer, educator, activist, and Larry Hamm, who's been organizing and agitating and protesting for more than a quarter of a century, chairperson of what Ken and I think is one of the most important organizations in the entire country.
The People's Organization for Progress, and we want a chapter in New York City.
Oh, we're still going there, right, Larry? New York
That's
City.
Right.
Well, thank you both for being with us at a very sober time in our history, in the history of Newark. And I want to begin with Junius Williams, your understanding, your involvement, your concerns. What do you write today of your role in the 1967 African-American rebellions in Newark?
Thank you and Ken for having me on. I appreciate this opportunity. I often listen to your show. As I wrote in my book, Unfinished Agenda, Urban Politics in the Era of Black Power, the Newark Rebellion was a central point in my young life at that time and in Newark's life. It was the first time I looked down the wrong end of a automatic shotgun, and fortunately walked away. The other part on Newark was a little more difficult. This was a series of events that led to the most important set of 5 days in the 20th century in Newark's history. People were feeling the pain before the rebellion. Rapacious landlords, store owners that cheated and gouged the public, welfare officials who didn't write checks when they should have, schools with white teachers who didn't particularly want to teach black kids, and when they did, they held them to a lower standard, and of course the police violence. That's what tipped it off. People need to understand, however, that there was a long history of black people and white people working together, trying to use a nonviolent approach, which had worked in the South, using demonstrations, picket lines, takeovers, trying to do what was necessary to give people some opportunity for redress of grievance because the power structure just was not listening.
I just want you to tell us a little bit more about the 12-gauge shotgun, just to give a real sense of the environment. And I guess it was 12-gauge, right?
No, it was automatic.
Automatic. Worse.
Not that it would have mattered. well, I and two other guys, we were riding up Court Street in Newark in my car. We were out after curfew on the second day, just looking to see what was going on. I heard the cop first, and I saw the light, said to myself, we are in some deep stuff. They pulled me over. We got out. They said, up against the car, mother, you know what? So we did that, and we stayed there while they searched the car. And what they found in my trunk were law books. The man with the shotgun, I call him Shotgun Man, and then there was Pistol Man. Pistol Man was pointing at us, hoping that we would run, but everybody was cool. But then the sergeant looked at their law books and told his men, their law students, let them go. And he had to say that three times. Now, he was supposed to be in charge, but they wanted to kill us. He finally talked them into getting back in the car. They put away their weapons, zoomed on up. I just thanked that sergeant.
Larry, Junius talked a bit about the causes of the rebellion. Do you want to flesh that out a bit? What was happening in Newark before the rebellion? What kicked it off?
Let me say, first of all, what a major contribution Junius Williams' book is, Unfinished Agenda. I have urged members of the People's Organization for Progress to read this book, and he really flushes out in detail, and he makes the events of those days, that period, very real. At the time of the rebellion, in July 67, I had just graduated from the eighth grade. I was at my friend's house. Some other friends came upstairs and said, Springfield Avenue is on fire. And we went to run downstairs, to run down to Springfield Avenue. But when I got downstairs, Junius, my mother was across the street on the porch. She was like, bring your behind back across the street. You're not going down there. By doing that, she probably saved my life. Conditions were very harsh. And it's not like today we have a picnic. I mean, conditions are still harsh. It's difficult for people to conceive. Most of the housing in Newark was substandard housing, cold water flat. And we lived for a time in a cold water flat. There was no running hot water. You had to get a big tub, put the tub on the stove, heat the tub up just to take a bath or to do anything else that you needed hot water for. In the black community, you know, most people's homes were heated by coal. And this coal heat was very unhealthy and contributed to the asthma. Many children have and still have asthma in urban areas because of the pollution. But the coal and the police were vicious at that time. We lived in an apartheid city. Newark was a predominantly black city with a white power structure. 90% of the police were white in Newark. So we looked at the police as an occupation force, almost like an army of foreigners that had come in to conquer and suppress us. So conditions were very bad. Housing was overcrowded. The city was segregated. Most black people lived in the Central Ward and close environs to the Central Ward because of redlining. You know, when I was a kid, to go to the South Ward, to go across Central Avenue, that was like going to another city. And it was just a matter of time before something happened. But I'm going to give you perspective. I didn't know that the riot was coming. I think it took a lot of people in our neighborhood by surprise.
Let me hold you on that for a second. Yep. So, Junius, we left off with Larry saying he didn't know he was coming, but he was a youngster at that time. Mm-hmm. Your experience, what did you understand about what almost had to happen and why, I don't know if you agree with me, but why I call it rebellions rather than riots, because rebellions are a different level of response to oppression. Your own thoughts.
Let me first thank Larry for that endorsement of my book. Yes, he did arrange for a book party at the People's Organization for Progress. And I want everybody to know that the first group we call upon if there is a crisis is POP. And I am a card-carrying member. So with respect to that proposition you put, we thought there was going to be a rebellion. And at the time, we all called it a riot. We had seen what had happened in Harlem. We'd seen what had happened in Watts. Harlem was 64. Watts was 65. Those of us who were organizing and were speculating as to whether it was going to happen. Mayor Adonijo was the one who didn't think it was going to happen. Mayor Adonijo was going to run for governor. He did not want that to happen because he wanted to be the first Italian governor of New Jersey. He was surprised, but we were not. Why was it a rebellion? Because, as you said, Mimi, when people can't take it anymore, they stand up. If somebody's got their foot up your behind all the time, and when you try to stand up, that's a rebellion when you try to stand up, because you are not going to just take this all the time. Now, if the courts had worked, fined the landlords and said, you can't do this, if the courts had said that about the store owners, if the welfare bureaucracy had been kinder if the school, I think they had maybe one or two black principals and most of the teachers were white, if there had been some accountability for what was not happening for the people of Newark on all of those fronts, then people would have said, well, we're going to try the nonviolent way. We're going to listen to Junius Williams and Tom Hayden, to all of these people in CORE and the UCC who are saying, well, let's have nonviolent protests and see if we can't change some people's minds. If that had happened, then there would not have been a rebellion. But when those police beat up cab driver, beat him senseless because he just passed them, because they were double parked on the street trying to get around them, and the people in the community, which was Hayes Homes, a high-rise public housing, hundreds of people out on the street on a hot night in July, when the people did that, saw that, they thought he was dead. So they decided to settle it Old Testament style.
Junius, the calling in of the National Guard, what happened after that?
That's an interesting story, too, because the mayor, according to the deputy mayor, Paul Riley, who I interviewed for our website, RiseUpNorth.com, according to deputy mayor Paul Riley, he didn't want the governor to come in and take over. But when you ask for help, that's what you get. So the governor called in, he mobilized the National Guard, he sent in the state police, and that, in essence, put the police, the local police, under the command of the state folks. They came in with one thing in mind, and that was to stop the violence. They didn't care about collateral damage, anything black that moved, they shot or beat or put in jail or some combination thereof. And that's how 26 people got killed, because there was no evidence of any snipers. The riot commission report that the governor set up, there was no evidence. I think there were 250, 230 reports of snipers. Nobody found any evidence, no spent shells, no fingerprints, nothing. They were shooting at each other or they were shooting up at these projects and at the people's houses, and that's how people got killed.
And let me just tell our listeners again that we're speaking with Junius Williams, who is an educator, a writer, an activist, a lawyer, and who was there and has written about four, really, the 50 years since the riots of, or rebellions, as the case may be, of July 12th, 1967. And Larry Hamm, chairperson of the People's Organization for Progress. Larry, and there's always that feeling, that sensitivity, that conditions are such that it may not be the same cold water flat, but I know how many people in New York are homeless. I know generally what class, and I know what racial group they belong to.
Right.
And so I'm still poised and would not be surprised given the police violence, et cetera. Is that true for you, Larry Hamm? Is that true for you, Junius Williams? Larry?
Yes. Until the conditions that gave rise to the rebellion are eliminated, there will be more rebellion. Black people have a long and complex history here in the Western Hemisphere and here in the United States. But one dimension of that historical experience that is not given adequate examination is the dimension of resistance and rebellion. Our history is a history of rebellion. That's why our theme year after year, because the People's Organization for Progress, we have held an observance of the 1967 rebellion and uprising every year of this will be the 34th year of the existence of our organization. And every year we have observed the 1967 Newark Rebellion because it was such a seminal event in the history of Newark, but not just Newark, in the history of black people in this country. The rebellion came into being because people were tired of being oppressed. And Junius talked about some of the conditions that existed. I mentioned some of the conditions, but many of those conditions continue to exist. One might make an argument, I mean, I haven't seen any hard figures on this, but there might actually be more portion of the population of Newark living in poverty today might actually be greater than it was in 1967. We know that there are twice as many poor people in America today as there were in 1967 and in 1968 when Dr. King was killed. Unemployment in black urban communities almost consistently somewhere between 40 to 60%, especially when you break out the demographic of black men from the ages of, say, 18 to 35, astronomical rates of unemployment and poverty, and not to mention the racism, particularly the racism and brutality of police. This is the witch's brew that, in fact, gives rise to uprisings. Black people have had urban uprisings in America in the beginning of the 20th century, after World War II, during the 60s, from 1960 to 1971. There were over 1,000 urban uprisings. There hasn't been a decade since 1967 when there hasn't been an eruption in one city or another. Most recently, we have Baltimore, and then before Baltimore, it was Ferguson. And there'll be another city probably this summer. And until the conditions are eliminated that give rise to this type of resistance, we'll continue to see these kinds of rebellion. But the 60s were a different period. I mean, in 67 and 68, between those 2 years alone, there were almost 400 rebellions in the United States.
I agree with what he said, and it could happen at any moment. I have a little different take on the quality of oppression at this point. And there was one very important missing ingredient. I think people's expectations have been dumbed down. People have accepted oppression as the new normal, whereas that didn't happen in the 60s because there were these unpredictable neighborhood groups of which I was a part and other people were a part, raising people's expectations, telling them, you have a right to the tree of life. We don't have that universally anymore. And so, yes, you do get a Baltimore, but it's not like a Newark or a Detroit. I don't think people expect very much anymore. And as a matter of fact, the symptom is that they are engaged in violence and the uprising is against one another. You got young people who are wearing red versus young people who are wearing blue. And what are they fighting for? They're fighting for a street corner. We were fighting for the liberation of an entire people. They have been accustomed now to just fighting for a street corner. I don't say that to put them down. That's just the objective reality. The young men and young women who are now in the Bloods and the Crips, back in 50 years ago, they would have been in SNCC. They would have been in CORE. They would have been in the Black Panthers. That was the basis of our nonviolent army, which was putting so much pressure on America that it had to do something. But it made the powers that be do something. Now all the powers that we have to do is say, well, they out of line, send in the police, and that's it.
Well, we do have the People's Organization for Progress, which is exactly that kind of organization. And I have to say, Junius Williams, I heard you say that same thing about 10 years ago, and I was just actually coming back from a trip to Rikers Island, and I thought and I looked at these wonderful young men and young women that were there and thought to myself, you were exactly right. The 60s and the 70s, they would have had a place to use their enormous creativity and their lust for liberation and empowerment in a holistic and comprehensive organization that spoke truth to power and was fighting for self-determination for a people. And that's some of what's missing today, as I think the ingredient. And the whole struggle for empowerment rather than a reactive struggle to respond to the latest police abuse of power. I don't know, Larry?
No, I agree with that. I think Larry Ham and People's Organization for Progress can't do it all.
I thought they could, actually.
In the 60s, there was a proliferation of these groups. Sometimes we got along with each other. Sometimes we didn't. But they were there with a network of folks. And young people just can't appreciate. One day you were at a demonstration with the welfare rights group. The next day you were with the NAFA, which was my organization fighting against the urban renewal. Another day you were with CORE fighting. We used to have a party on Thursday, every Thursday in the NAFA organization. And we would plan out our week about what we were going to do. And you just don't have that level of engagement so that people would then go for
Larry Ham.
I agree with Junius in the general sense that, yes, we are faced with a more challenging set of conditions. We have to examine why that is. Part of the reason is certainly the counterinsurgency measures that were taken against the Black Liberation Movement of the 60s. When we rebelled, we were met with the force of the state, with open violence and with other surreptitious means, the infiltration of Black organizations, the assassination of Black leaders. Probably the most well-known of these efforts was COINTELPRO. There was COINTELPRO, and then there were COINTELPRO-like operations that were carried out by local police departments. Local police departments were known to have a Black desk or a red desk for radicals and communists and so on. And so there was a concerted effort, both using soft counterinsurgency measures as well as hard, violent counterinsurgency measures to meet what they thought was a revolutionary situation in America. I mean, if you had almost 150 uprisings in your cities across the country every year, you would be very concerned if you were in power. And so the FBI and the intelligence agencies of various kinds of the military, they went to work to, in fact, undermine and destroy Black organizations. But in part, that is why there is this disconnect. That's one of the reasons why we don't have the plethora of Black liberation-type organizations that we did. Because Junius is right, that we did have the 60s. I mean, I can just name, in Newark alone, there was a Committee for a Unified Newark. There was a Black Panther Party. There was CORE, led by Bob Kerman. There was the NAACP. There was the Black People's Topographical Research Center. I could go on and on and on naming these groups. And most of these groups don't exist today. And they don't exist because the state, in one way or another, moved against them. And I think this is the real issue right now. The question is, how do we link the struggles for both reform in the struggle to change and improve our condition, how do we link the struggle for revolutionary transformation to the struggles for immediate reform? Because this was another stumbling block of the Black Liberation Movement during the 60s. You know, we thought, and naively so, not all of us, but many of us thought, if we just elect Black faces to high places, as Brother Amiri Baraka used to say, you know, everything will be all right because the brothers and sisters will get in there and they'll take care of us. Well, that didn't happen. And in some instances, these, for lack of another term, another one, these neo-colonial type situations where you had a kind of Black municipal power structure that was, in fact, under the domination of the larger white power structure, we found ourselves at odds many times with the very people that we had helped to bring to power. Junius Williams got me out of jail. I got locked up by the Black City Council president in 1974 because he didn't like what I said about what the city council was doing regarding a housing project that Amiri Baraka was attached to in the Central Ward. He had me arrested on the spot, dragged out and taken to the jail. And I had to call my wife to call Junius Williams to sit there to come get me out of jail the next morning. But this is a real issue that we had to confront, this question. You know, Nkrumah wrote the book Neocolonialism, The Last Stage of Imperialism. I mean, we're not an independent country. We're not a colony. But there is a colonial type kind of relationship that exists. And after Black power, we've had 40 years of Black power now, you know, and what that has to be assessed. What was its revolutionary value? What was its counter-revolutionary value? I mean, these things have to be assessed and summed up. And Junius does that to a degree in his book.
Junius, so I can't help but say we have Mayor Raz Baraka and Amiri Baraka, really the poet laureate of revolution, of self-determination, who was intimately involved at that time in the life, blood, literally, of Newark, was himself brutally beaten. We now have his son, who is the mayor, just in the final time. What do you think that means? Is there some kind of vindication that Raz is now the mayor of Newark, his lineage being from Amiri Baraka, after all that you all went through and continue to go through as people who are progressives, as people who are humanists, as people who are fighting for our empowerment in very clearly worsening times? Junius, Williams?
Let's just follow the logic that Brother Larry just laid out very well. Because we did have people who were in power and didn't understand the nature of the reality, and because they were good people but didn't have any kind of ideological concept of what to do. I say in my book, the power in the street must accompany the power in the suite, the suite being City Hall. What happened was that all the people that Larry talked about and that I talked about, we were either driven away from City Hall, or people left down, or people died. And as a result, that knowledge base went away from us. So the next generation, and now another generation, and now another generation, knows nothing about the kind of organization that we're talking about. Larry is almost as old as I am, and he's still one of the few who understands community organization. Not just mobilization, but organization. That whole thing has left us. So now we have Raz Baraka, who understands all of this, but his resources have been cut severely. But I think he is doing as much as could possibly be done. I don't think we're going to have a rebellion on his watch. For example, he has said we're going to have a police review board, and he has set up a police review board. That hasn't happened in very many cities with the approval of the mayor. He says we're going to have a new set of policy with respect to hiring people. He has called upon the people who have the jobs and the economic wherewithal, and he said, within a certain amount of time, I don't remember exactly.
Well, you know, I'm gonna have to cut you there. We've just got to have more of these conversations and longer because they're too important not to. People must read. It's such a critical book. Unfinished Agenda, Urban Politics in the Era of Black Power by the extraordinary Junius Williams. Go to his website, Rise Up North. It is excellent. There's so much on it. And, of course, Larry Hamm, who's going to be commemorating the 50th anniversary of the 1967 Newark Rebellion, from slave resistance to urban uprising in Newark, New Jersey.
And Mimi, let me slip this in. To kick off 5 days of commemoration, we have the mayor. We're going to go through the history of the rebellion, young people talking, gospel choir singing, Sister Stephanie and her jubilation choir.
Thank you. Two of the finest brothers that I've ever met and had the pleasure of organizing with. Larry Hamm, Junius Williams, it's an honor.
Thank you
for having us on.
Oh, yes, you know it. We will do it again. Thank you.
Let's pick up where we left off.
All right.
Always. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
To transgender service members now, are they immediately thrown out of the military?
That's something that the Department of Defense and the White House will have to work together as implementation takes place.
This was a shocking assault on transgender troops who've been serving honorably and effectively.
My phone blew up from other service members who were concerned about what this meant for them. Do we still have a job? Will we still have a job? Can I continue to serve?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Chinese worker wins the country's first trans job bias lawsuit, Taipei grants parental leave to same-gender couples, and Trump trashes trans military service in Twitter tirade. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending July 29th, 2017.
I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump flipped the proverbial bird this week to LGBTQ people three times in a single day. July 26th began with an early morning tweet from the president stating that transgender people will not be allowed to serve in the U.S. Armed Forces in any capacity. The announcement apparently took everyone at the Pentagon by surprise, including vacationing Defense Secretary James Mattis, and virtually every White House official who was asked about it. Later in the day, Trump announced that he was nominating notoriously homophobic Kansas Governor Sam Brownback to the State Department post of Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom. The far-right Republican has opposed virtually every pro-queer rights advance throughout his political career and has acted when he could to deny equality to LGBTQ people. And without being asked, Trump's Justice Department filed a brief in a federal court case on the same day involving employment discrimination based on sexual orientation. Lawyers for the gay plaintiff argued that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 protected him from such bias. The friend of the court brief, filed by the Jeff Sessions-led Department of Justice at the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in New York, argues that it does not.
LGBTQ rights activists, like the ACLU's James Essex, warn that these moves signal a concerted effort by Trump to push back against the Obama queer rights advances. Essex told the New York Times that, whether coordinated or not, to have it all happen on the same day certainly brings into focus the profoundly anti-LGBT agenda of this administration. It will come as no surprise that far-right Christian fundamentalist groups like the Family Research Council applauded Trump for his tweets banning military service by transgender people. Its leader, Tony Perkins, praised the president for rescuing our troops from the grip of the Obama years. We'll have comprehensive coverage of Trump's tweeted military trans ban later on most of these same This Way Out stations.
With respect to the friend of the court brief filed by the Justice Department in the workplace bias lawsuit, the case began in 2010. That's when Donald Zarda, a skydiving instructor, filed suit against his employer, Altitude Express, charging that his firing for being gay violated provisions in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that banned sex discrimination. legal observers expressed surprise that the Justice Department brief was filed at all. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission normally weighs in on discrimination cases involving private employers. In fact, the appeals court had asked only the EEOC and not the Justice Department for its opinion. The commission and a few lower courts in recent years concluded that the Civil Rights Act's ban on sex discrimination should be interpreted as including protections based on sexual orientation. But the Justice Department said in its brief this week that courts should deny those protections to gays and lesbians.
By contrast, equality activists in China are celebrating the first-ever court ruling siding with a transgender person in a workplace discrimination lawsuit. The 29-year-old plaintiff, known only as Mr. C, announced on July 27th that a court in the southwestern city of Guiyang ruled that his rights were violated when his employer fired him in 2015 because of his gender identity. Mr. C charged that Siming Checkup, a health services company, sacked him for wearing men's clothes. He said his supervisors told him that he looked like a lesbian and would damage the company's reputation. Experts on labor law and gender issues reportedly testified on Mr. C's behalf. In finding for Mr. C, the court also decided that workers should not face discrimination based on their ethnicity, race, gender, or religious beliefs, and awarded Mr. C the equivalent of about $300 US in damages. "It's never been about the money," Mr. C told reporters. "We hope through this case that people in similar situations will realize they have a right, and we hope it will eventually result in a workplace anti-discrimination law." While the monetary compensation was modest, activists say that reports of the trans-supportive ruling in the Chinese press will help to educate a generally ignorant public about gender identity issues. "Although the case has ended," Mr. C told reporters, "we still have a long way to go."
Even though lawmakers in Taiwan started the ball rolling toward marriage equality last month, it could take up to 2 years for the legislation to finally make it through parliament. While everyone is waiting, officials in Taipei City have made it the first jurisdiction on the island to offer paternity and maternity leave for parents in same-gender relationships. The city will also soon allow lesbian and gay couples to apply for public housing. Regulations governing the rental of affordable public housing in the city have been updated to expand the definition of family members to include same-gender couples who have entered their partnerships in Taipei's household registry. The city began offering that symbolic relationship recognition in 2015. The first applications by same-gender couples for public housing are expected to be approved in mid-August.
In other news, the Texas Senate has approved a bill requiring trans people to use public bathrooms and other sex-segregated public facilities that conform to the gender on their birth certificates, including facilities in public schools. Republican Governor Greg Abbott, who faces re-election next year, has made this such a high priority that he called the legislature back into special session this week to get his so-called bathroom bill passed. Wrangling between minority moderates and far-right social conservatives in the Republican-dominated chamber almost prevented Senate passage in May during the regular legislative session, but the bill failed to advance in the House. Major Texas-based corporations have come out against the legislation, and so have most of the state's law enforcement groups. Nevertheless, the Texas Senate voted 21-10 to advance the bill on July 25th. Like North Carolina's ill-fated HB 2 and its equally discriminatory so-called replacement, HB 142, the Texas measure also bans local jurisdictions in the state from passing ordinances allowing transgender people to use the bathroom of their choice. The bill now moves to the House, where its fate is uncertain. Republican Speaker Joe Strauss reportedly maintains his strong opposition to its passage.
New Jersey Republican Governor Chris Christie surprised some observers this week by signing two bills advancing the rights of his state's transgender citizens. One bans medical practitioners from refusing service to someone based on their gender identity. It also prevents insurance companies from denying coverage to a trans person under pre-existing condition exclusions. The other newly minted law calls for a supportive and non-discriminatory environment for trans children in New Jersey's public schools that includes a clear non-discrimination policy and respect for a child's non-conforming gender identity. Christie also signed a bill earlier this year that banned cure therapy that claims to make gay people straight for anyone under the age of 18.
Rhode Island became the fourth U.S. state this year to ban so-called conversion or reparative therapy for minors when Governor Gina Raimondo signed a bill into law to do just that on July 19th. Virtually every major physical and mental health organization in the U.S. has condemned cure therapy as useless at best and more often than not psychologically damaging at worst, including the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, and the American Academy of Pediatrics. However, with the addition of Rhode Island, only 10 of the 50 U.S. states, along with the District of Columbia, have enacted measures to outlaw the debunked practice.
And finally, a right-wing zealot has turned the idea of religious freedom on its head by suing four Democrats in the U.S. Congress for displaying rainbow pride flags outside their D.C. offices. Chris Sevier claims that homosexuality is a religion and that displays of the pride flag violate the separation of church and state. He filed individual lawsuits this week against Representatives Susan Davis and Alan Lowenthal of California, Representative Don Beyer of Virginia, and Representative Earl Blumenthal of Oregon. Sevier has a long history of homophobic hysteria. He fought against marriage equality and has also asked a federal judge to overturn the U.S. Supreme Court's 2003 ruling striking down state sodomy laws that had made gay sex a crime. There's no sign that any of the targeted lawmakers are feeling threatened by Sevier's efforts. Congresswoman Davis, in fact, noted the overwhelming backing she's received from her colleagues on both sides of the aisle and claimed that other representatives are planning to add the rainbow flag outside their offices in support. "Be assured," she said, "that hateful lawsuits such as this are not going to stop the march toward equality and the celebration of diversity."
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 29th, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
July 26th, 5:55 a.m.
After consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow...
July 26th, 6:04 a.m.
Transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military... Our military must be focused on decisive and overwhelming...
July 26th, 6:08 a.m.
Victory and cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgender in the military would entail.
Late night TV host Stephen Colbert's dramatic interpretation of U.S. President Donald Trump's triple tweet threat to ban transgender people from military service was not the only drama caused by the abrupt announcement. It caused drama at the Pentagon, where military leaders were caught off guard. It caused drama in the halls of Congress, where it drew bipartisan condemnations. It caused drama at that day's White House press briefing, where Press Secretary Sandra Huckabee Sanders had to explain the president's action.
What happens to transgender service members now? Are they immediately thrown out of the military?
That's something that the Department of Defense and the White House will have to work together as implementation takes place and is done so lawfully. So I would imagine the Department of Defense will be the lead on that and keep you posted as that takes place. The president's expressed concern since this Obama policy came into effect But he's also voiced that this is a very expensive and disruptive policy. And based on consultation that he's had with his national security team, came to the conclusion that it erodes military readiness and unit cohesion, and made the decision based on that. The president made the decision yesterday. The Secretary of Defense was immediately informed, as were the rest of the national security team that had been part of this ongoing conversation.
The sudden, unexpected policy shift also caused drama for thousands of trans service members who were thrown into limbo, and it's still unclear exactly how the policy will change, if at all. Trans people have been serving openly since last year under an Obama administration decision, but Trump Defense Secretary James Mattis said a month ago that he wanted further study before allowing new trans enlistees. Mattis was on vacation when Trump tweeted his new plan. In his absence, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair General Joseph Dunford issued a statement saying that the policy would remain unchanged until an official directive and guidance on implementation was received. Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Looked at the status of trans service members now with an out and proud example.
According to the Trans Military Project, some 15,500 transgender individuals currently serve in the U.S. military. Transgender people are twice as likely to serve than cisgender people, and there's no other known organization that employs more transgender people than the U.S. military.
I am a soldier at Fort Lewis, Washington. I serve in the 2-3 Infantry.
Staff Sergeant Patricia King was the first infantry member to reveal she's transgender. King has served in the Army for 18 years, including 3 active combat deployments to Afghanistan. Staff Sergeant Patricia King, your response to the presidential announcement yesterday.
My phone blew up from other service members who were concerned about what this meant for them. Do we still have a job? Will we still have a job? Can I continue to serve? And I woke up very much in a state of shock. My first reaction was, did I just get fired via tweet? And from there, I moved on, and I calmed my fellow service members down, and we banded together, as we always do. And then I laced up my boots, and just like any other day, I went to work. The truth is that people still didn't know. I was the first person to tell my chain of command what had happened. My leadership was quick to reassure me and say that they supported me, that they have my back, and that we're a team, and that they were in my corner.
So what exactly does this mean? I mean, if he is banning all service members who are trans, are they going to be going to bases all over the world, not to mention bases here like yours, Fort Lewis, and kick you out?
You know, I couldn't speak to what's going to happen next. What I know is that I've been serving for 18 years now. I've served honorably and proudly, and it's my intention to continue to serve. So it's my goal to make it so that I can do that.
Now, the Pentagon has made gender reassignment a covered health benefit, as ordered by the Obama administration. What would it mean to transgender service members to lose this benefit?
Well, I don't think that health care should be considered a benefit, first of all. We have to remember that what the previous Secretary of Defense said was that all medically necessary care will be covered. And it's hard to consider something that's medically necessary a benefit. Most of us who serve, the most important thing to us is the ability to continue serving our country. So while my health care is a concern, my major concern right now is that I've been serving this country for almost 2 decades. I love my country, and I just want to be able to continue to serve.
A study by the RAND Corporation estimates gender reassignment treatments would cost the military between $2.5 million and $8.5 million annually. By comparison, the total military spending on erectile dysfunction drugs amounts to 10 times as much annually. Your response to this, Staff Sergeant King?
Well, I'm fortunate not to need erectile dysfunction medication.
Staff Sergeant Patricia King, I want to thank you for being with us. First infantry member to reveal that she is transgender. King has served in the Army for 18 years, including 3 active combat deployments to Afghanistan.
Aaron Belkin teaches political science at San Francisco State University and directs the POM Center, a think tank for research on gender, sexuality, and the military. During an interview with Pacifica Radio News,
Belkin dissected Trump's claims of excessive health care costs for transgender troops, as well as the supposed difficulties integrating trans service members into the ranks.
This was a complete surprise and a shocking assault on transgender troops who have been serving honorably and effectively for the past year. We know from testimony by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that transgender military service works. We know from the 18 foreign militaries that allow transgender troops to serve that transgender military service works. And so to recreate Don't Ask, Don't Tell on the basis of fake data about costs and ostensible disruptions is really shocking. People in the military have been treated well over the past year, and the Palm Center has been tracking about 24 transgender troops all year. Some of them have undergone gender transition and some of them have not, and implementation has been a success. Implementation, as predicted by all of the research, including the military's own research, has promoted readiness. It's common sense that when you force people to live a lie, you force them to serve in silence, it makes it harder for them to do their jobs. And when you treat them according to the same standards as everybody else and just let them serve honestly and openly, that makes it a little bit easier for everybody to do their job.
That was Aaron Belkin of the Palm Center. There was outrage from both sides of the aisle in both houses of Congress over the Trump tweets. Democratic Representative Barbara Lee of California made note of a historic coincidence.
69 years ago, President Truman ordered the integration of the armed forces, affirming that there shall be equality of treatment and opportunity for all. And this means all.
Massachusetts Representative Joe Kennedy III also chimed in.
Our president has told thousands of American soldiers that they will fight for us, but we will not fight for them. He said that our military couldn't or wouldn't stand for all of us. Ladies and gentlemen, our troops do not discriminate.
The big surprise was the negative reactions from a number of conservative congressional Republicans. No less than Senator John McCain of Arizona, Orrin Hatch of Utah, Joni Ernst of Iowa, and Richard Shelby of Alabama, as well as several House members, expressed strong opposition to banning trans people from military service. In fact, the whole storm may have started in the House. Earlier in the week, a measure was defeated to cut transgender medical benefits from a defense spending bill in order to pay for Trump's promised wall along the Mexican border. Proponents of that measure may have influenced the president's sudden decision. Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman spoke with longtime trans activist and founder of the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, Dean Spade, about how the alleged trans ban fits into the larger political picture.
I wanted to talk to you about your comment on Facebook. You said, "The liberation we are working toward requires we fight for vets and everyone else who gets exploited and abandoned for U.S. military imperialism, but not that we participate in rhetoric that celebrates the U.S. military as an employer or ties trans well-being to military service." Can you elaborate on this?
Yeah, Amy, I'm concerned that the ways in which this debate gets pitched kind of puts trans people on one side, usually framed as kind of like willing soldiers with absolutely no critique of U.S. military imperialism or of the U.S. military as an extremely exploitative and abandoning employer, right? We know the statistics about vet suicide rates, the abandonment of vets in terms of access to real mental health care. You've widely covered the sexual assault levels in the U.S. military. There's lots of new data about the U.S. military as one of the largest polluters, or maybe the largest polluter on the planet. So when we lose our critique of militarism and of the U.S. military in this debate, what happens, in my view, is that trans people become sort of a symbolic space in which to have basically pro-military advocacy and PR. And so to me, the military inclusion campaign, both for lesbians and gays and for trans people, has often fallen into that trap, only representing the military as a great place to work that does wonderful things to protect our country, which is not, I think, a progressive view. And it rebrands the military as a site of liberation and progressive politics, which it's fundamentally not. The U.S. military, right, is, you know, one of the largest sources of violence on the planet Earth. And so my question is sort of, how can we have a more complex conversation about the fact that, yes, trans people are poor and underemployed and need real jobs, but the option should not be one of the most dangerous and exploitative jobs possible? That's not actually, I think, what trans collective liberation is actually about. And so I'm kind of concerned about the way this conversation tends to get framed. Perhaps This is less about Trump's, like, invested transphobia, which, of course, he's happy to throw trans people away, but it's more about his desire to build his wall and his desire to get his huge defense budget passed. So I think we need to ask, like, how are trans issues being used politically, and is it really about trans people's well-being or not? Whenever we look at this question, we have to say, you know, how has the U.S. military had a history of recruiting very vulnerable populations who face limited economic opportunity? I spent my career working with very low-income trans people struggling to have housing and employment and basic health services. And the idea that we are framing it as you should have to join the military to get basic housing, health services, and employment is really concerning to me. So I think it's vital, actually, that we look at this in a broad, big-picture way, which does not mean not supporting people who are currently struggling with their jobs in the military or as vets. But I think we really are missing the ways that trans issues are being sort of used as a political symbol rather than this coming from an actual concern about trans people's well-being.
Kristen Beck, the 20-year veteran of the Navy SEALs, including SEAL Team 6, which killed Osama bin Laden, challenged President Trump Wednesday over the ban. She's the first transgender Navy SEAL. She told the news site Business Insider, "Let's meet face to face, and you tell me I'm not worthy. Transgender doesn't matter. Do your service," she said.
That was Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman with trans activist and law professor Dean Spade. There's been no further comment from the White House about how to reconcile President Trump's pronouncement with procedural reality. In closing, we return to late night host Stephen Colbert. He ended his recitation of the presidential trans-banning tweet stream with a recognizable but audience-approved expletive deleted, and then counseled a crestfallen Caitlyn Jenner.
Victory and cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgender in the military would entail. Thank you. Thank you?
In my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens.
The whole thing took Trump supporter Caitlyn Jenner by surprise. She tweeted, "There are 15,000 patriotic transgender Americans in the U.S. military fighting for us all. What happened to your promise to fight for them?" Caitlyn, I don't know if I'm the first person to break this to you, but he's a liar.
God bless your transsexual heart. To trans forever. To trans forever.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week, John Dyer V and Francis O'Brien, produced by Steve Pride, contributed program material with special thanks to Pacifica Radio News and Democracy Now! Against Me performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KWTF Bodega Bay, California, CFUR Prince George, British Columbia, 2CHR Cessnock, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA. My name is C.S. Song. Alan Watts, the philosopher and comparative religion scholar, was one of the foremost interpreters of Eastern thought and philosophy for audiences in the U.S. The author of more than two dozen books, Watts also happened to be a programmer at KPFA in Berkeley for 20 years, beginning in 1953. Today, the last day that we come to ask you for your support for Against the Grain during this KPFA's summer fund drive, we present portions of two talks that are part of the Alan Watts Library Collection, a compilation of 28 hours. 28 hours worth of talks that Alan Watts gave over the course of two decades. Later this hour, we'll present a talk called Insight and Ecstasy, but we begin with portions of a presentation by Watts on the fundamentals of Buddhism. And by the way, this sprawling 28-hour Alan Watts library collection is your thank you gift for a one-year, $180 pledge to listener-supported KPFA. The phone number to call anytime this hour is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, easily remembered as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And you can break the $180, you can break the $180 down into 6 monthly installments of $30 each, if you like. Let's turn now to excerpts from a presentation by Alan Watts called Fundamentals of Buddhism. When he refers to Gautama, he's referring to the 6th century BC Indian figure whom we identify as the Buddha. We take up Watts's talk as he's discussing a certain kind of freedom.
Freedom from an emotional habit, the habit of grasping at one's own life, at seeking for continuity. And you see, the idea of continuity in Buddhist philosophy is that we desire continuity in order to perpetuate our past. In our past, in other words, we have accumulated various things. Experiences, material goods, knowledge, virtues, power, so on. The desire for continuity is the desire for the perpetuation of a past self or string of selves with which we identify ourselves. And Buddhist insight involves the recognition that the past is perpetually vanishing. There really is no past to continue, and therefore to cling to it, to identify oneself with it, is to perpetuate an illusion resulting in incessant frustration. Now, Gotama made it very easy to summarize his teaching. He was really quite an adept in what we call mnemonics, in putting things in simple form so that they could easily be remembered. And he summed up the whole of his doctrine in what is called the Fourfold Noble Truths. And it's based on an old medical formula. In ancient India, as in almost all ancient cultures, every activity was ceremonialized. And when a physician came to pay his call, he gave his diagnosis in a ceremonial way. He made four pronouncements. The first pronouncement was the name of the disease. The second, the cause of the disease. The third, the curability of the disease. Can it be cured? Yes or no? And if it can be cured, the fourth pronouncement is the giving of the prescription. And that's exactly the form of Gotama's summary of his doctrine. He said, in other words, the first principle is that mankind, and indeed all forms of life, suffer from a disease, which is called in Sanskrit dukkha. And the most general translation of that word is suffering. Dukkha means suffering in all its forms, moral, physical, spiritual. But Western interpreters of Buddhism have sometimes represented him as saying that life is suffering, period. In other words, of enunciating a highly pessimistic and world-hating doctrine that to be alive is to suffer, and that, in other words, the amount of joy, of positive pleasure in life is, after all, so negligible that the game is not worth the candle. Now, if one studies the method of teaching of sages in ancient India, you have to realize that one of their fundamental pedagogical gambits is to arrive at the point of view they wish to inculcate by a zigzag method. When we walk, you know, we put down maybe first the left foot, then we shift to the right foot, then the left foot, then the right foot. And in this way, we go along, neither to the left nor to the right, but straight ahead. And you find, too, that in thought, that the human mind tends to go from position to position, but it always, when it settles on any fixed position, we can always point out that that position is an extreme. For example, in scholastic philosophy in the Middle Ages, when St. Thomas Aquinas fastened on the idea that God is fundamentally ends or being, a Buddhist philosopher would point out that he had settled upon an extreme that has an opposite, non-being, and that therefore his position needs to be corrected by the opposite position. Somebody else should get up and say, no, no, God is not being, God is non-being. And from this facing of opposites with each other, we arrive at what Buddhism is sometimes called the middle way. Doesn't mean the compromise position. The middle way is the doctrine of relativity, of showing that all positions or experiences which we can formulate must always be perceived or known by contrast with their opposites. So in other words, Buddha's doctrine that life is fundamentally dukkha or suffering is an antithesis directed towards those people who believe that the object of life is to attain sukha, or sweetness, pleasure. He is saying, in other words, you cannot experience pleasure except in reference to non-pleasure. And therefore, the more you pursue pleasure, the more non-pleasure will arise to frustrate you. The more you pursue permanence, the more you will feel the impermanence of things. And so it is, for after all, when we are bent on enjoying ourselves, we become at that very moment curiously aware of how rapidly time is slipping by. When, on the other hand, we are not enjoying ourselves, we become curiously aware of how time is dragging. So then, dukkha, arising from an exaggerated pursuit of sukha, its opposite, becomes the basic characteristic of life. And he goes on to say, in his second principle, that the cause of this is trishna, or grasping, sometimes translated desire, and indeed I believe the word trishna does underlie etymologically the English word thirst. But trishna is not quite desire. For example, one's appetite. When you haven't eaten for some time and you get hungry, this is not trishna. It's a perfectly natural occurrence. Trishna is based in turn on avidya, which means unwisdom, or simply lack of insight, lack of consciousness, lack of, well, a special sense of ignorance, not the ordinary sense of ignorance of not being informed, but ignorance, action based on ignoring something. And ignorance is not realizing the relativity of experiences, not realizing the inseparability of pleasure and pain, existence and non-existence, life and death, up and down, good and bad. So that as a result of such ignorance or unwisdom, people try to separate these opposites from each other, to corral, to gain the good ones, and to exclude and annihilate the bad ones. And as a result of that, because these opposites exist mutually, they go round in circles. And that mutual existence of these opposites is really, it seems to me, the basic meaning of the doctrine of karma, which is involved in Buddhism, the doctrine of conditioned action, which Buddha epitomized in the phrase, this arises, that becomes. In other words, without this on the one hand, or this on the one hand always implies that on the other, good on the one hand implies bad on the other, and so on and so forth. And so, if a person becomes involved in karma, involved in conditioned action, leading to a vicious circle, if he is ignorant of the interdependence of all states of experience. So then the third truth, the cure of this dukkha or suffering, is the truth about nirvana. Nirvana is the most grossly mistranslated word in all foreign languages, probably. Because we are early scholars of Buddhism translated it as annihilation, and nowadays nirvana means a state of being doped up to most people. It's popularly used as being in ecstasy or in a kind of dreamy bliss. And nirvana doesn't mean that at all. It's a state of being very, very wide awake. State of being completely aware. But the etymology of the word is disputed. There are several etymologies that you can offer, and so I just choose the one I like. And that is to blow out. As when, having tried to hold one's breath, you discover that you can't hold it. You lose your breath by holding it. Therefore, you expire, you despirate. And so you heave a sigh of relief. And so nirvana is the sigh of relief, the expiration or despiration. In other words, the giving up of the attempt to clutch at life. hold it in a fixed form, to resist change, to separate the good side of things from the bad side and annihilate the bad side. It is the giving up of that fundamentally contradictory, self-contradictory kind of conduct. And so then in the fourth truth, there is set out the Noble Eightfold Path, Buddha's prescription for dukkha. And the Noble Eightfold Path is really in three divisions, one of which concerns itself with understanding, might almost say intellectual understanding of the doctrine. The one is concerned with conduct, and the third part of it is concerned with state of consciousness or meditation. Now, to summarize them briefly, the first stages of the path, such as a right view, or I prefer to translate the word samyak, not so much as right, but as perfect in the Greek sense of telos, or complete, and thus to have a complete view is a view which does not take sides, which takes the middle path, which in other words does not go off to extremes, and so on. The part of the Eightfold Path that is concerned with conduct. Buddhism is often represented as having a very exalted ethical system, and this is true, in a way it does. But also one must recognize the difference between Buddhism and Christianity, as at any rate as Christianity is ordinarily taught, is that these ethical ideas are not commandments. They are really forms of expedient conduct. The Buddha counseled his followers to take upon themselves certain obligations, say of not killing, of not stealing, of not exploiting the senses, of not getting drunk or intoxicated with poisons, not lying. Not because these were against the will of God or against the fundamental laws of the universe, but because they are inexpedient forms of conduct for a person who wants to wake up. After all, if you get thoroughly doped up, you're not liable to be very wide awake. And then, finally, the end of the path, the last stages of it, are concerned with one state of consciousness, with the process of what is sometimes called meditation, or of bringing one's mind to its maximum awareness through clear recollection, and then finally the attainment of what is called samadhi, which means integrated consciousness. Consciousness no longer under the influence of avidya, no longer bamboozled and fooled by the apparent separateness of things which are really inseparably interlinked. And thus samadhi could be called integrated, a unified consciousness in which it is seen that the subject, the knower, is inseparable from the object, the known, that man is inseparable from the totality of life, and so on and so forth. So that samadhi at the end of the Eightfold Path might be described as being the entry to, or realization, the making real of, the state of nirvana, which constitutes in turn being a Buddha.
That's Alan Watts, the philosopher, the lecturer, the author, the influential interpreter of Eastern thought and philosophy for audiences in the U.S. And that was a talk, that was portions of a talk that he gave called Fundamentals of Buddhism. And I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA. We are going to move shortly to another talk that he gave called Insight and Ecstasy. But I want to let you know how you can get not just a little, but a whole lot of Alan Watts to listen to at your leisure and to enjoy and to learn from. And that is the Alan Watts Library Collection. The Alan Watts Library Collection is a collection of 28 hours of talks and presentations and lectures by Alan Watts, 28 hours on three MP3 CDs. And that is yours for a $180 one-year pledge to KPFA. $180 to KPFA gets you this amazing, this extraordinary, this information and insight-packed Alan Watts Library Collection, 28 hours on three MP3 CDs. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, or simply 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Hey, KPFA, I'd like to give some money and get an extraordinarily high value thank you gift in the form of this 28-hour Alan Watts collection compilation on three MP3 CDs. And also, in addition, we have a combo pack of Alan Watts today, and that is a dollar a day to KPFA. That's a $365 pledge for those of you who have that kind of money and who like Alan Watts, who perhaps love Alan Watts, who perhaps have heard Alan Watts before on KPFA. And for a dollar a day to KPFA, you get not just the Alan Watts Library Collection, all 28 hours of it, but you also get a set of three DVDs. One of the DVDs is called Why Not Now, and it's a documentary on the life and work and ideas and perspectives of Alan Watts. It was made by his son, Mark Watts. And that is one part of this three DVD set. The second part is a bonus disc of video material that they could not fit into the film. And the third is a special film. It's called The Animated Alan Watts. And it's just what you're thinking. It's animation via which they convey many of the thoughts and insights that Alan Watts shared with his audiences over many, many years. So the animated Alan Watts, the bonus disc, and the documentary film Why Not Now about Alan Watts, that's a three DVD set, and the Alan Watts Library Collection, all yours for a dollar a day to KPFA, a $365 pledge to KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Alan Watts was a scholar of comparative philosophy and psychology. He held a master's degree in theology. He, for a number of years, he taught comparative philosophy. He wrote more than 25 books. His books have been translated into at least 11 languages. He had a radio program on KPFA for 20 years, beginning in 1953, and he was considered one of the major figures who brought Eastern philosophy and thought to the West. He has a penetrating mind, a penetrating voice, as you might agree, and he has been sharing, or he did share, a lot of information about Buddhism to a lot of people out here, including in the Bay Area, who were really interested and who still are interested in what Buddhism can offer to them in terms of how to live, how to think, how to be. So again, we're going to go back to more of Alan Watts, but again, 1-800-439-5732 is the phone number, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge online at kpfa.org on your computer, on your iPad, or your mobile phone. And you get the, really, this is a fantastic value. We're not going to do better this drive. A 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection for a $180 pledge to KPFA, which you can break down into six monthly installments of $30 each, so $30 per month over 6 months. Or for a $365 pledge, you get both the Alan Watts Library Collection and the three DVDs of Alan Watts, about Alan Watts, the films about Alan Watts and his life and his thought. 1-800-439-5732. Let's turn now to another talk in this sprawling Alan Watts Library Collection. It's called Insight and Ecstasy.
I think it's terribly important to understand that if you're interested in Eastern philosophy, if you're studying Hinduism or Buddhism or something of that kind, with the object of attaining ecstasy, that this is a complete misunderstanding. There must really be a distinction
between ecstasy, that is to say, the thrill, the kick, the delight, the joy of a mystical experience and the experience itself. Because the experience itself may or may not have ecstasy as a consequence. That is simply a byproduct. The experience itself is always a matter of insight. And the insight, the understanding of the way things are, what you are, what life is, may indeed produce ecstasy, because sometimes this understanding is an enormous relief. And that is the reason when one has been battling, say, with some tremendous problem and suddenly finds the whole thing disappears, when you've been terrified at something or anxious about something and all the grounds for anxiety vanish, then very naturally you feel enormously happy and joyous. And also I would add that the kind of insight which is the essence or the core of this sort of experience has a way of making the ordinary everyday world seem extraordinarily beautiful. And that again is a byproduct. Whereas things before seemed rather dim and oppressive. You know how even on a fine day, if you're feeling sad or depressed, the actual landscape somehow looks dimmer. Whereas on the other hand, if you're feeling wonderful, the landscape itself looks wonderful. And so in the same way, if one has had certain insights which bring about an extraordinary sense of relief from the oppression of certain problems, then very naturally, everything in the world looks a lot better. And you could even go so far as to say it seems transfused with a divine light. Speaking first of all from, say, a Buddhist standpoint, there's no doubt in my mind that the insight in question that constitutes what is called Satori in Zen, or in more general Buddhism, Bodhi, which means awakening, this is not the vision of something like a God underlying the world. Although Buddhist philosophy occasionally uses expressions like the great void, or suchness, or the Dharmakaya, the absolute reality, and thus gives the impression that it has a belief in some sort of continuum underlying the world, in rather the same way that water is a continuum in which fish move and air is the continuum in which men move. There are many, many texts in the literature of Mahayana Buddhism which explicitly deny that this is the meaning. It would be much more correct to describe what they call the void as a state of complete mental clarity in which one ceases entirely to be bothered by false problems. Because the basic thesis of Buddhist philosophy is that the sufferings, the agonies of mankind, especially the psychological ones, derive almost entirely from false problems, from bothering our heads over questions that are not real questions at all. And when these problems are solved, when it is seen that we were asking the wrong question, then one gets this astonishing sensation of seeing that problems exist only, as it were, in a mental sphere. They exist as a result of thought. Whereas the world which is not thought, the world which simply is entirely free from problems. Now, of course, that is something extraordinarily contrary to our general common sense. We think the physical world is full of problems, and we have thought as a valuable instrument to enable us to solve them. And it's true, thought is a valuable instrument. But
Valuable, we might ask, for whom? Valuable for those who can use it. But not so valuable for those who are used by it. Those who, in other words, are hoodwinked by thinking into problems which would not exist otherwise, and which really have no reason to exist. Now let us take, as a simple example, the common philosophical problem with which we've been obsessed in the West for centuries. The problems which are called ontology, or the study of being, and the problems of epistemology, the study of knowledge. These problems very largely have to do with the inquiry as to who or what I am, that's epistemology, and who or what the whole universe is, that is ontology. And they derive from what appears to be the common sense feeling that processes of any kind, actions of any kind, have to have behind them an agent. In other words, if we know, we ask very naturally the question, who or what knows? If we see a movement or an action, we ask who or what moves? And underlying the whole history of scientific inquiry until quite recent times, there has been the urge to know what ultimately underlies the process of the universe. And you see, this has its roots in the historic division of life into two categories. The category of substance and that of function. We always seem to feel that wherever we see activity, operation, movement, energy, that there must be some thing which does it. Now, many of you who've read the writings of that extraordinarily interesting American linguist, Benjamin Lee Whorf, will remember how he pointed out the arbitrariness of this distinction between events and things. How, for example, he showed that very often in our language, phenomena which are clearly events are masquerading in words which seem to suggest that they are things. And he made some most interesting discussions in his book, Language, Thought, and Reality, about what we really mean by the distinction between these two classes, to which we assign in our language nouns for things and verbs for events. But of course, in recent philosophy, it's become more and more clear to us that we can use verb language, or process language, or operational language, to discuss almost anything we want. Any natural phenomenon can be described as doing rather than being. And in general, this is a very useful way of talking about things. We, in other words, dispense with an unnecessary duality in language, an unnecessary distinction between process and entity. And what appear to be entities can always be described in terms of perhaps a slower type of process than the things we've normally described by verbs. And if we consider this, then, and start talking about everything that happens in process language, in operational language, we suddenly see that things or entities, that is to say, the who or what that does something, the agent behind the act, these things completely disappear. A famous instance which Whorf gave of this was in the Hopi language, that when we say a light flashed, the Hopis just say flashed. And he pointed out that's much more accurate because the flashing is, of course, the light. But in this way, we have created a thing behind the act, which is a sort of ghost. And the objective of Buddhist Discipline is, as one old Zen master put it, to beat the ghosts out of you. Now, in the same way, you see, when we know something or we act, it's a very basic common sense supposition that we are the agent behind the actor. That, in other words, behind thought there's a thinker, behind experience an experiencer, behind perception a perceiver. And we are, all of us, you see, tremendously concerned with this image, the doer, the agent, which has become our image of ourselves. You might call it our self-image, if you speak in a psychological jargon. And this is the thing we're all concerned about. Its future, its history, its destiny, what's going to become of it, and so on and so forth. But through clarity, it can turn out that this thing that we fancy ourselves to be simply is a figure of thought or a figure of speech and is not there at all. And the only reason why this makes us feel astounded and bothered and unbelieving is the momentum of a habit of thought. It may become sort of intellectually clear to us that this is so, we still have deep in us the habit of attributing all actions to an agent. And it's difficult for us to realize, to become really clear, that this is only figurative. That there is no, as it were, distinct order of being that is the doer as distinct from the deed. So one is then confronted, when one realizes this vividly, with the astonishing realization that one is not this entity that one supposed oneself to be, that one is not being pushed around by laws of physical necessity. The difficulty is, you see, that thought is, as it were, a system of symbols that stands apart from life and represents it. Just as words stand apart from things and represent them. They don't really stand apart from them. Words are noises and thoughts are sensations or images. And they only apparently stand apart. Well, as we identify ourselves to so large an extent with our thinking process, we naturally come to feel that we, too, stand apart from life. And as a result of this, we have the customary feeling that when we're not distracted with thought, we are... I have a curious feeling of emptiness, of having no time, of being very, well, just being evaporating histories. But of course, if you stand apart from life, you're dead. But we don't really stand apart, but we think we do. And therefore, when one recovers from that illusion, and the sense of one's separateness, of one's being a thing, an agent, simply disappears. It's not a kind of fatalistic situation, because the feeling of fatalism is that one is the agent, but one is being pushed around. And so this disappearance and this loss of the sense of separation between the subject and the object, the thinker and thought, and in turn thought and life, could be called, you see, a sense of unity, to which one might, if one were a Christian, give the sense of a union with God. But a Buddhist doesn't give it that sense. And since it involves release from the problem of oneself, the lifting of a colossal burden from one's shoulders, there may ensue ecstasy. But the ecstasy itself has nothing to do with it. It's simply a byproduct of the insight of living in a physical world that is totally free from most of the thought problems, if not all the thought problems, about which we continuously beat our bodies and our brains.
Alan Watts, philosopher, scholar, author, lecturer, broadcaster, interpreter of Eastern thought philosophy. I could listen to this guy all day. And in fact, now you can too, because we're offering not 2 hours of Alan Watts or 10 or 15 or 20, but 28 hours of Alan Watts on three MP3 CDs. It's called the Alan Watts Library Collection, and it is chock full of talks and presentations and insights and lectures. There's even a small part that has involves answering questions and requests from listeners, because as I mentioned, he was a KPFA radio programmer for 20 years, beginning in 1953. This 28-hour collection or compilation of Alan Watts can be yours for, and we've pushed to make this an affordable pledge amount, relatively speaking. So a $180 pledge gets you this 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection. And the phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain. This is the last time I'm coming to you live. This drive, for purposes of raising money specifically for this program, this is the last Against the Grain slot, time slot, this fund drive, noon to one, Monday through Wednesday. And so we want to have a big finale, and that's why I often pull out Alan Watts for such a finale, because he is such an interesting and provocative and insightful person. And his words are, you might agree, timeless. 1-800-439-5732. $180 gets you the Alan Watts Library Collection. But I've told you, and I'll tell you again now, that we are offering an Alan Watts combo pack. $1 a day to KPFA gets you not only the Alan Watts Library Collection, but also three films about Alan Watts on three DVDs. One film is called Why Not Now? It's a documentary on the life and ideas of Alan Watts, made by his son Mark Watts. The second is a bonus disc of video material that they couldn't fit into the film. And the third is called The Animated Alan Watts. All of that, the three DVDs, the three films on three DVDs, plus the 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection, yours for $1 a day to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. I'm going to read you some of the titles of the dozens and dozens of talks and presentations on this Alan Watts Library Collection, yours for a $180 pledge, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You heard portions of Insight and Ecstasy and of Fundamentals of Buddhism this hour. Also, there are talks entitled and the sheer variety of topics he takes up is very impressive. The Art of Psychoanalysis, Fundamentals of Eastern Philosophy, Discussion of Buddhist Mysticism, Paul Tillich on the Eternal Now, the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of the Lord. And so clearly, Mr. Watts was not interested just in Buddhism. He was interested in Eastern thought and did a lot of study and presentations about other forms of thought coming from India and from China and Japan and so forth. There are parallels, thoughts, East and West, a very interesting talk that he gives. Levels of Magnification. There's a tribute to C.G. Jung, The Symbolic and the Real, the title of another talk on this 28-hour collection. Man is a Hoax, The Constitution of Nature, The Libido for Ugliness. That sounds very interesting. The Future of Christian Philosophy, Conscience and Concentration. On and on. Philosophy East and West, I guess there was a series on that. The kind of a nice comparative analysis of philosophies, of ways of thinking. Art, philosophy, and self-improvement, philosophy as music. There's even a talk he gave on astrology. And I mentioned that Alan Watts was a programmer on KPFA for 20 years. I think the vast majority of those programs were, in fact, him just talking, substantive talks by Alan Watts, and many of them are part of this 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection. $180 pledge gets you the entire Alan Watts Library Collection, and just think about how much insight you could get from 28 hours of Alan Watts, not to mention what we played for you today. 1-800-439 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. And in the remaining 12 minutes of the last time again that Sasha and I will ask for your support for what we do here on Against the Grain, this program, which we consider to be distinctive because, you know, we're a little strange and idiosyncratic, and we like to do things a little differently, and we like to cover issues in a certain way that you might find distinctive or unusual or maybe a little more comprehensive or a little more contextual, maybe a little more nuanced. If you support this program and you want something fantastic in return for your donation, so you're giving and you're getting at the same time, give us a call at 1-800-439-5732. The final match, the final challenge grant, you might say, of this fund drive for Against the Grain comes from Nolan from Petaluma, Chris V from Oakland, and JK from San Francisco. They've put up $800 conditionally, and you probably know the routine, which is that we need to raise $800 from all of you out there collectively to match these folks, Nolan, Chris, and JK, so that we can accept their $800 from them. So there's a lot of money on the line. This is the biggest match of our drive, in terms of the drive during which Against the Grain has come to you live. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. If you can give us $180 and get this 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection, and you can only really get it here, folks. So this is your chance to get it. This comes from the Pacifica Radio Archives. $180, it becomes $360 because of Nolan, Chris, and JK. If you want to give us $1 a day to KPFA for the combo pack of the Library Collection Plus, the three films about Alan Watts, that comes out to 365 times two, which is something like $730 to KPFA because of this matching grant, which only lasts for the next 9.5 minutes. Give us a call. KPFA.org is another way to reach us. Alan Watts was born in London. He studied with the Buddhist scholars D.T. Suzuki and Christmas Humphreys. He moved to the U.S. in 1939, where he became famous as a leader of the Bay Area counterculture in the 60s. He played a critical role in the integration of Eastern philosophy into the emerging Western worldview of his time. Joseph Campbell, the great scholar of mythology and religion and philosophy, praised Alan Watts' efforts to convey the history and development of Eastern thought. And there is so much in here. It's beyond description. I mean, I can't possibly begin to encapsulate 28 hours of Alan Watts talking about the big issues of our time, the meaning of life, the pursuit of happiness, how our minds work, the nature of reality, comparative emphases of Eastern and Western philosophies, the interconnectedness of things. He's a great storyteller. There's quite a bit of humor in this Alan Watts Library Collection. There's philosophy, there's politics, there is sociology, there's anthropology. There is so much in this very rich library collection. $180 for 28 hours, not an hour or 2 hours, 28 hours of Alan Watts. 1-800-439-5732. Buddhism and Alan Watts have so much to say about how we are taught to be, how we are conditioned, what we are conditioned to do and to be, how we are socialized. Is it helpful or harmful? Do we do the right thing in relation to ourselves, to other people, to our children? Do we do them justice? And I know there are a lot of deep thinkers out there. We try and get a lot of deep thinking guests on our program, Against the Grain. And I think a lot of our deep-thinking listeners, I know a lot of our deep-thinking listeners are interested in the big questions, and many of you I know are interested in Buddhism, excuse me, are intrigued by Buddhism, are fascinated by Buddhist insights. I have been fascinated by Buddhist insights for a long time, and I, you know, when I was first exposed to Buddhist insights, it was so contrary to my habitual ways of thinking, to the ways that I perceive things, the ways I viewed things. And, you know, attitude is everything. I mean, attitude is a huge part of our experience in the world. And Buddhism really came along and changed so much, and it continues to seep in, right? I'm still working on it. And maybe those of you in Eastern philosophy and specifically Buddhism are still kind of working on these concepts and applying these concepts in your everyday life. 1-800-439-5732. Get the Alan Watts Library Collection. Help us make our match. Help send a message to management that Alan Watts has support, that Against the Grain has support, that we're doing right by our listeners, that we're doing something that listeners care about and that they depend on and that they rely on, and that maybe they share with other people via social media. Maybe you get Against the Grain via a podcast. Maybe you listen to it live. Maybe you go to kpfa.org. Maybe you appreciate the time and effort that it takes to really explore ideas in depth with our listeners. Well, there are a ton of ideas presented by Alan Watts in this library collection. Again, $180 pledge gets you the 28-hour Library Collection, Alan Watts Library Collection, and the $365, that's a dollar a day to KPFA, not just Alan Watts to listen to on the Library Collection, but three films to listen and to enjoy and to watch, of course. One made by Mark Watts, his son, who I have met and talked to, a charming man, very committed to disseminating the insights of his father, Alan Watts. Why not now? Again, another a bonus disc of video material. They took up so much video, or they found so much video, they couldn't fit it into the film. So there's another bonus disc of DVD of just this video material, a lot of stuff that they couldn't fit in the film. And then there is something by the animated Alan Watts, and I believe one of the South Park animators participated in the making of the animated Alan Watts. Give us a call. We need your support. Your dollars are doubled. We want to hear from you. Alan Watts is about moving beyond, as I mentioned, kind of our conventional ways of thinking, our habitual ways of thinking. Our culture is, in a sense, hypnotizes us. And nothing really comes along in our everyday lives, in our ordinary lives, to dehypnotize us. We just buy into these ways of thinking, these methods of thinking, these habits of thinking that have been kind of drummed into our heads pretty much all our lives. But for many of us, it's not the answer. It's not the path or the way to... I'm not even talking about enlightenment here. I'm just talking about to equanimity, to peace of mind, to our abilities to get along with other people, not to be disturbed by what's going on around us. Although I'm not saying we shouldn't be disturbed by a fair amount of what's going on around us. But what Alan Watts is saying is that Buddhism tells us that many of our problems are false problems. And if we can stop being bothered by false problems, if we can stop asking the wrong questions, if we can stop framing things in terms of the thoughts that we have that kind of take over reality, that we impose on reality, and that we can begin to live precisely in the moment without preconceptions and without frameworks that we bring to mind that are often habitual, maybe based on the way we were brought up, or, you know, maybe we were abused, or maybe we were mistreated and we have fears and anxieties. And so we bring all of that to the current moment. If we can somehow get beyond that to the core of what it means to live in the moment and to enjoy the current moment and to see other people as they are, as opposed to seeing them the way we want to see them or the way we've chosen to pigeonhole them, then we get to a kind of happiness and peace and contentment that may not constitute enlightenment, because maybe none of us will ever become the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh, but will make our lives much more gratifying and satisfying. Gratifying and satisfying. 1-800-439-5732. We've only got 2 minutes left. I've been talking a lot. 1-800-439-5732. Consider giving right now. Go into your phones. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. 2 hours left to make this match. You can join Ian Leek or Like in San Leandro. Thank you so much, Ian. Bernice Tuck in Fresno. Thank you much so much, Bernice. We've got some interesting names here. Tony Power in Napa. Love to hear from the North Bay. Thank you, Tony. Pauline Aragon in San Leandro. Thank you so much, Pauline. Dale Axelrod in Petaluma. Oh, I think it's Petaluma. Thank you so much. And some of these folks want the Alan Watts Library Collection. Some of them want the whole schmiggy, the $1 a day Alan Watts combo pack. Give us a call. Let us know you're there. Alan Watts talks on this 28-hour audio collection about technology, about Taoism, about the possibility of human extinction, about the basic ideas of Hinduism. He talks about education. He talks about society. He tells a lot of stories. He illustrates his points. It's not just abstract philosophical speculation. And he says that our lives from grade school through retirement are a hoax. Find out what he means by that. 1-800-439-5732. Not too late to call. Not too late. I'm not offering a little bit of Alan Watts. I'm offering a lot of Alan Watts. Alan Watts that you can digestible chunks that you can listen to and get a lot out of. Every time you sit down, you can choose how often to listen, how much to listen to. 1-800-439-5732.